from the high desert in the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening and good morning, as the case may be across all these many time zones, stretching from the Tahitian and Hawaiian island chains all the way eastward to the Caribbean, in the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north well to the pole, the magnetic North Pole, and worldwide, of course, on the Internet. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. Hi. We are going to go venturing into a world this morning bigger than you could possibly imagine. It is kind of like outer space, travel in outer space, except it's not. It's travel into inner space. We're going to do a program this morning on something called nanotechnology. Machines with moving parts so small that with the naked eye you could not possibly see them or discern their operation. My guest is a man I had on about a year and a half ago, Charles Osman, and I'll tell you more about Charles in a moment. And oh, by the way, guess what, folks? The first crop circle of the year, as you know, has already occurred, and guess who has a photograph? So if you want to go up to the website and take a look, and it really is neat, because, of course, the crop is new, so it's green. This crop circle occurred instead of in mature wheat or something, in a green field. And it is beautiful. And, of course, it's on the website, which is where you should be. That would be www.artbell.com. www.artbell.com. It is beginning early this year, indicating, no doubt, there's going to be a lot of crop circles. What are crop circles? Well, I don't know. You tell me. A lot of people think they are fractal, particularly the more complex ones, like Stonehenge, with 191 circles, and that they are either a message or have meaning. Nobody really knows what they are, but they certainly are, and they are not the product of Doug and Dave with a board and some chains tromping about. So you go take a look at the first crop circle of the year. It's on the website now. Now, nanotechnology. What in the world is that? I've got a man who knows. His name is Charles Osman. I had him on the air, I'm going to guess, about a year, year and a half ago. He is a member of the Science Advisory Board of NanoThink. NanoThink. A privately funded nanotechnology think tank and development research facilitation for a consulting group. He's also a senior fellow of the Foresight Institute. That's not Farsight, Foresight, folks. A senior fellow of the Institute for Global Futures. Currently the science editor and author for Mondo 2000 magazine. I'm sure you've heard of that. Technical editor and author for Midnight Engineering. And contributing editor, author of Robotics Digest. He's also currently authoring a piece for the IEEE Spectrum on the topic of biomolecular nanocomputing systems and devices. Good Lord. That has a kind of an interesting connotation to it. Charles, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You really have your plate kind of full there, don't you?
And it's brimming over, but in a way, this is a very good metaphor to symbolically represent the world we're about to be thrust into, very much in kind of the same way that you depicted this process that you refer to as the quickening, where mm-hmm. the compression in the temporal domain. I'm looking at compression and convergence in the functionality domain.
Meaning, that's a big mouthful. I take that to mean a compression and convergence of
a very wide plethora of different types of industries, scientific disciplines, and even socioeconomic systems, which up until fairly recently were still relatively autonomous, self-contained process engines that would produce some kind of product, service, and or scientific discipline-oriented results as part of a development stream that resided within their own autonomous realm. That does not exist anymore. Everything is becoming ever more interconnected.
Interconnected, yes.
That's correct. And this process is being driven by this connectivity grid, which we now call the Internet. And I date back to the very early days. I'm an old crusty fellow. I date back to quite a few decades ago, really, back in the National Lab System, when the Internet then was developed for the National Lab System as nothing
right.
more than a communication network.
Correct.
It's gone far beyond that. And yet, even back in those early days, there were a few what were considered perhaps on the fringe kind of people that speculated at some threshold moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
The connectivity factor went up to about where it is now. Everything would be poised at a almost like a cliff, if you will, where the rate of change and the volume of change processes would simultaneously converge so that every technology is interconnected to every other technology.
I would like to get your thoughts, if I could, on the Internet itself, where it has gone, where it presently is, and where it's going, and what it means for society. What are your thoughts on it?
Oh, wonderfully you should ask this, and I'll start by saying approximately 2 years ago, I wrote a paper, a technical thesis, a refereed paper called The Internet as an Organism, which I submitted to the European Society of Artificial Intelligence and Cybernetics, and they have their annual conference in Austria. To my astonishment, they not only published the paper, which was no small feat itself, but when I got back to proceedings, roughly about a third of the other participants, most of whom were professors from various universities around the world, India, former Soviet Union, all over Europe, the United States, Canada, etc., had very similar ideas. They were using terms like the global Gaia being encapsulated in the synthetic neural net engine, you know, things that really would have sounded completely off the grid to most folks, but to me made perfectly good sense. And I thought, okay, here we are, a bunch of different people in different parts of the planet, but we had a very, very similar vision of how this process is evolving. And therefore, I submit to you the following idea, that an organism in itself is self-correcting, self-modifying, it grows, it adapts, it will, at a certain point, spawn, you know, offspring of sorts,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you have going on in the Internet now. You have a hopefully benign, but what I see to be an involuntary symbiosis between the human species and this connectivity system, which in fact does have self-modifying, self-correcting properties. You already have companies like NTT and ATT developing neural net-driven and even genetic algorithm-driven routing structures to optimize performance of the peak load pattern set.
Oh, well, hold on. You're getting ahead of the average person out there.
Okay, well, I'll back away.
Back away a little bit.
All right,
you said, with regard to the Internet, hopefully benign.
Yes.
Now, that indicates to me you're not sure.
Well, and no one is. It's all a matter of ratios of probability. And in the book that I'm currently working on, I study this problem rather carefully. I have a whole series of sort of what I call option graphs. And say, under these criteria, this potential series of outcomes could arise. And I want to offer the following thing. The fact that we are heading into an enormous change is, in fact, absolutely the way it is. Some people look at prophecy and talk about some sort of calamity due to a huge commerce. And some people talk about a spiritual calamity. Some people talk about huge weather changes and so forth. I actually don't focus on that at all. But what I do focus on is a socioeconomic upheaval on a scale never before experienced in human history. There's going to be a mantle of chaos that this process, this convergence and this quickening will sort of come up against. It'll be like a barrier. It'll be like the next evolutionary test, if you will. And if we, as an organism, can successfully negotiate this test, we'll come through it as a more robust organism, as a more robust society, as a process. If we fail, we'll be sort of mired in our own socioeconomic chaos, and we're about 2, 3, maybe 5 years max away from that horizon.
Are you familiar with Michael Crichton's theory about the Internet?
Yes, and in fact, I understand what he's getting at. His basic theorem is that just as you have biodiversity in an ecosystem to make a more robust ecosystem, you should have behavioral diversity or cultural diversity to maintain the health of the society.
Very good. That it will squash diversity.
And I understand this. I mean, before the Internet days, people would travel around the world. Americans would go somewhere else abroad, and they'd see an Americanization of some autonomous nation state that used to have its own separate little culture. And it would be like a flattening out of the uniqueness of where they had just gone to. That's like the organic version of what Michael is now referring to in this, what I call the virtual terraform. But that may or may not be the case. there are quite a few variables. It's like a node on a decision tree, and which branch gets activated, I think, relies upon a very complex set of conditions leading to that node occurs. But I want to offer one more thought here. That is that what the Internet is doing now is only a precursor to what's about to happen.
Well, tell us.
Because I visualize a realm in where experiential conveyance becomes the methodology by which education, marketing, the interaction between other people throughout the world. Right now we have something called Vermal, which is a virtual reality modeling language that allows you to have interactive 3D environments come through the wire and appear on your computer screen or
right.
a TV set.
Right.
And it's still very primitive, very crude. A bunch of my friends who are part of the technical community are right at the very forefront of creating these things. But I see it as a blink in the eye. Just a little niche because...
I think what you're saying, let me try and...
Sure.
I've got to stop you, otherwise you're going to race ahead of the audience. But you seem to be trying to say that there's going to be an Internet, or what is going to be, whatever grows into the Internet, what it's going to be, and a connection, a biological direct connection to human beings.
Not only biological in the physical sense, but also in the mental sense. What I'm about to try to explain is the concept of synthetic sentience as an engineerable, deliverable commodity.
Oh, brother.
And as a matter of fact, if you want to look at socioeconomic system paradigms, we are shifting, even now as we speak, away from a hard asset-based commodity-driven system.
Doesn't that drive us toward a single consciousness, though, that will make us, to use Star Trekism, Borg-like?
In a sense, that is one of the possible options, and that's why this is a test. Every time the human species, and I think this has happened many times in many other worlds throughout the known universe, I think this was a very common rote series of processes that any organism would go through, an intelligent organism. So here we've climbed this ladder. As we get to these rungs, which are ever more closely spaced, by the way, the risk-gain ratio volume of that rung provides us the potential of traumatic failure or the potential of spectacular growth. And each one is an increment larger than the one before. I mean, we've already survived global warfare, global nuclear warfare, the coin is still being flipped as to whether or not we suppress the biosphere's capacity to support life beyond what it is now, and I think, you know, the bets are still off on that one. But racing up along this is the essence that we have the potential of utilizing this experiential conveyance engine as a methodology for enhancing one's educational potential. And let me see if I can communicate what I'm trying to say here. I first saw the most compelling version of virtual reality quite a few years ago, not with goggles and gloves and trying to shoot at something like you've seen in an arcade. No, that's done. That's stupid, that's right. What I saw was the following. A friend of mine who unfortunately passed away, his dream was to capture the great archaeological sites throughout the world, especially ones which are trapped in politically difficult circumstances, like Baalbek in Iraq or Angkor Wat in Cambodia.
Sure.
And or many of the sites that are now crumbling away because of heat and an explosion to pollution, that sort of thing. The point is that by capturing these things and making these very elaborate virtual models, you can then not only preserve them, but allow the community around the world to visit the same site and have the same experience, but more importantly, the efficiency by which that experience is conveyed cannot be matched by any other medium. And here's the proof. I went to Brazil as part of an international virtual reality consortium demonstration. This was about 5-6 years ago, actually. And here I was on stage in downtown Rio. And this fellow had dragged along his Everson Southern supercomputer, this huge, enormous box. He was heading out of this place, something called a Leaf Helmet. And we had people coming up on stage from all walks of life, all genders, young kids, old folks, people that drove cabs for a living, college professors, you name it, many of whom didn't speak English at all. They could put on that helmet. And suddenly they were inside of a 5,000-year-old African city called Buhan, which at that time was the capital of the Nubian Empire, which is now the Sudan. In other words, unless you were a professional archaeologist that could go to some obscure library and find the right book and read about it, you would never even know this place existed, let alone have a sense for who these people were, the culture, the spectacular beauty of the buildings and the complexity of their sociology and so on. And yet you've got all of that stuff almost instantaneously within a matter of seconds.
You see it, you hear it, you feel it.
Right. You sense it, you experience it.
However,
yeah.
What I sense that you're talking about is a step beyond that. In other words, that's only delivering in a very indirect way to your senses what we're talking about. What you seem to be talking about is something, a direct connection to the neural...
And that's around... It's being done now, but you're stepping ahead, so forgive me. I'm going to hold you back just a little bit, but you're going in the right direction. I want to see this to the audience and to the general world who's listening in a way that really can... There's a logical event stream that I want to make sure we don't skip a step.
All right.
So we've gotten to the point of experiential conveyance. We have a knowledge engine, you might say, and we now have things called autonomous agents. These are smart entities that represent your interest. They are sentient. They fly the fabric of the net, if you will, looking for things of interest, looking for things that they have learned about because they know your behaviors and how you respond. It becomes an extension of yourself because of the ever more rapid rate of change and the ever more increasing scale of complexity.
All right, I've got to stop you now for a second. Now, you said you have these entities, these sentient entities traveling the Internet.
Correct.
What are these? What do you mean by that?
Okay, this goes back, again, I'm going to have to back out here just ever so slightly. Again, mostly financed by the military. There was an interest, and it still is, of course. There's a language called SOAR, S-O-A-R, which is an artificial intelligence paradigm, which I won't go into details about. So, but the point is, SOAR and other protocols of this nature were deployed to create synthetic environments that could be populated with autonomous agent entities. This way, they could simulate the behavior of soldiers in the field in a battlefield situation, because a battlefield commander, by today's standards, the timeline between decision boundaries, where you have multiple threads of information streaming in constantly, and the decision loops are measured in a matter of seconds.
I think I'd better ask you to define sentient.
Okay. Sentience, in its ultimate form, is self-awareness. You really become an autonomous entity. You are now aware that you exist, and you begin to adopt the mannerisms that would determine that you, on your own, can learn, adapt, function and decide willingly that you want to divorce yourself from whoever created you and sort of do your own thing, to put it as plainly as possible.
Now, would these sentient entities be a creation, or are they going to be a byproduct of just some critical mass moment that we reach with regard to the net?
Both. And that's where the... thank you for having put it in that phrase, because there's a logic to it that I have to explain.
All right, and explain it you shall. We're at a break point. Relax. You're going about 100 miles an hour. We could use about 70.
Okay.
Stay right where you are. It pours forth from him, doesn't it? Charles Ossman is an expert in something called nanotechnology. Sit down, put on your thinking cap, and I think you're going to be surprised at what's coming. I'm Art Bell.
Call Art Bell toll-free, west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255, 1-800-618-8255, east of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033, 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
It sounds a little like Tales from the Dark Side. Maybe it is. Or maybe it's going to be our savior. But imagine what we just heard. The Internet. Interconnected, growing. Constantly becoming more interconnected. I believe the Internet, they say now, is doubling in size every 3 or 4 months. My guest is Charles Ossman. We're going to be talking about nanotechnology. But he just suggested we're close to a point now where there will be born... virtually, or created, or both, on the Internet, individual sentient beings, aware beings, that will be part of the net. Try and imagine that. Try and imagine that. Back now to Charles Ostman. Charles, I'm visualizing that quite well in my mind. What I guess I don't understand is, what do you think or imagine might be the critical moment in speed, storage, interconnectivity that would either begin to produce or allow to be produced the sentient beings we talked about?
Well, this is just the problem that I'm currently working on. And you should bring this up. But I want to back away just a little bit because I want to make sure that we don't skip a crucial step. There really is a specific, like a logic tree structure.
Sure.
I want to make sure all the branches actually do hook together.
Sure.
So getting up to this point, you have to have a motivation or a fiduciary incentive, you might say, to translate this technology development into a realm in which it actually can be evaluated and become a primary component in the virtual terraform-based business and economic subsystems in the near future, which is why I keep harping on this idea of the virtual asset-based commodity-driven system, where it won't be things that you can touch or sense in the normal way. It'll be intangibles. It'll be things like the quality of knowledge, engineering knowledge on demand, synthetic sentience, ubiquitous computing, supercomputing, what would appear to be supercomputing from our perspective, having a box that sits at home, is it going to be replaced by what you might call an intelligent orifice that simply hooks into the functionality fabric that's out there, and that out there keeps expanding and growing to an ever larger capacity.
When you say an intelligent orifice, now we have Mac computers, we have IBMs. Define the difference between what we have now and what you're calling an intelligent orifice.
Okay. A typical machine has a CPU, some glue logic, some bus interface, all the sort of usual stuff that,
right,
is physical to the machine, if that's what you see in there.
Right.
This is about to be changed, and the change will happen rather quickly, in my opinion, because I already know the people who are sort of inventing the tools to make this possible.
Well, I do know that if you buy a computer today, it's out of date in about 2 or 3 months.
That's exactly right. It's one that were to actually read Gartner Group, Forrester, and all the professional logistics analysis people that supply this kind of information. You're actually right. The aggregate average lifetime profitability window, if you will, a piece of hardware that goes out on the shelf, if you don't capture your expected profit returns in three months, it doesn't justify the shelf space it occupies. And software is a matter of weeks. And
talk about a rough business.
It's a very rough business.
Yeah.
And so the way to accommodate that requirement, I mean, the business, the house of cards, it's going to collapse in on itself. So the answer is to have machines that evolve, that are soft, that are, in a sense, gelware. As opposed to being hardware and or software, they are gelware. You have a
gel, wait a minute, stop. Gelware.
Yes.
Are you talking about a biological entity now?
Well, in its ultimate extension, yes. In the interim, it'll be using traditional silicon, only something called FPGAs and SPGAs, which are read-writable, they're like memory in a sense, except that you have functionality matrices that sort of rewrite themselves on a per-instruction cycle or several instruction cycle spaces. And now you have an intelligence out there. Right now you have Java applets and Java code,
right,
that can actually go into your machine, if you will, and sort of rewrite the machine's identity, if you want to call it that, on a per-function as per-needed basis. There's another whole world up there called Corba, and Corba is a virtual state machine where in software, residing in the ubiquitous functionality fabric of all these interconnected nodes out there, you have a virtual bus structure, you have virtual code engines, if you will, that are surrounded by a prophylactic-like wall of identity tags.
Frank, you are saying a lot of things that are blowing right by me, and I somehow you've got to make us understand. If they're blown by me, they're blown by a lot of other people.
All right. Consider this. Us people, us entities, it used to be until not too long ago that we were our own self-contained units, if you will. Our intelligence was inside our head. Our bodies were just that, our
right,
bodies, and
right,
we had a belief barrier, you might say. We could commit to the believing of what our senses and our internal processing would allow us to be convinced that this was real and this was the stuff we were interconnecting with.
Mm-hmm.
That's about to change. The whole idea of the invocation of rapture, if you want to call that, as an engineerable process, is being done now in very subtle ways. I mean, it happens in a certain context when you go see a movie and you surrender into that movie for a couple of hours. You have a vicarious experience and you're drawn into a story that you might be watching on your television set.
Right.
In the old days, it was glyphs on pieces of paper, called writing. You'd surrender yourself into a book. Well, what's about to come around the corner, instead of the monodirectional broadcast what's called push technology, where you have an orthogonal storyboard structure punctuated by advertising slots, and if the advertisers are lucky, they might get 3% hit rate on the return on their investment for how many people watch the show versus what kind of response they get to selling their product.
Match.
Imagine a bi-directional, immersive environment where instead of watching Cheers, you become part of Cheers.
Of Cheers.
And you go into this virtual domain, populated by, I'm not kidding, no, virtual actors and actresses.
Uh-huh.
They have a conversation. You get to learn about them. The reward for participation is the depth of emotional engagement you establish with these virtual entities.
Could I go back like to 90210 for a while?
Sure, oh. Or anything you want. And the point is, the reward for investing in that kind of infrastructure is that now you can back-annotate the psycho- and socio-demographic data streams that come from the activity of you participating in that environment. Now, all of a sudden, I could perhaps have a 30% hit rate of what I can sell you as opposed to 3%.
Uh-huh.
This is very attractive stuff. Virtual malls, virtual entertainment domains, where everything is connected in an intelligence fabric. This is big money.
Let's stay with commercials for a second.
Sure.
You're suggesting that you would be so immersed in this material that you would understand, without being told...
Right.
Or being told in a very special way precisely why you should need and want this product, it would be a real straight-on piece of communication that you could not ignore. Very powerful tool.
Very powerful tool, also a very dangerous tool, depending on how it's misapplied.
Yes.
I want to offer an idea, for instance. Char Davies was the co-founder of Softimage, one of the big software houses out there that manufactures rendering software for 3D modeling and so forth.
Right.
A very wonderful woman, very extremely intelligent, and I respect her work highly. She wanted to try an experiment. She wanted to find out where this threshold of surrendering for one's belief barrier really occurs. So she developed a virtual world called Osmos. And most virtual reality stuff you see today is still pretty boring and kind of like, oh, it's just a model of something you would see in the real world, a street, a house, a building or something, very mundane stuff. I submit that virtual worlds are infinite. You could be inside of an atom or sitting inside of an entire universe. In other words, the idea of limiting this conveyance engine to something as mundane as the replication of what you already see.
Okay, hold on.
Okay.
We're talking about causing a person's belief system to be surrendered to whatever material you're streaming toward,
correct.
Them, right? And
correct.
Where is, how do you find that threshold, or where is that threshold?
The invocation of rapture as an engineerable process has certain emotional and cognitive cue points, and that's what's being measured now. And I want to give you Chardy's example. In her world called Osmos, you literally drift into a world where there is no up, down, left, and or right. It's like scuba diving. She happens to scuba dive, so she made a metaphor. But you put on a suit of sensors, in a sense. It measures your chest volumetric displacement, measures your heart rate, GSR, and other biokinetic data and so forth. In other words, every essence of your bioprocessing activities are sort of fed into this environment that corresponds to your state of mind as well as your physiological state.
This is done, Charles, so it understands how it is affecting you, and therefore, if it is not affecting you in a certain way, with respiration or heartbeat or whatever, it then will modify its approach?
A little bit. And there's no sentience with this system. All she was wanting to do was measure...
I've got you.
...to what extent a person would sort of become immersed and sort of establish themselves as part of this environment. After about 45 minutes or so of this kind of interactive exposure, most people were so interconnected in all ways, and that both subliminal and consciously, that when they disconnected themselves from the environment, they really had to go through a recovery period. They sort of stumble around and kind of have to readapt to the real world. And this was a very benign, very pleasant, aesthetically soft, you might say, experiment. My vision is that this kind of technology were applied in a much harsher way. I mean, if you look, for instance, at Saturday morning television, and you see the incredible production work that goes into the TV ads, you see, where they really want to reach inside the skull of some 8-year-old kid who's going to rush off and pester mommy to buy the box of cereal or whatever.
That's right.
Imagine if you magnify that by an order of magnitude. I can see some very serious, there's cause for trepidation. And as a person who develops this kind of stuff, I understand what's at stake. And so this is like one very small sliver, however, of a much larger arena of functionality. So I'm going to take the next step, which is, as life becomes ever more quickened, as you would say it, and as functional complexity goes up, the ability for a single human being to render mission-critical decisions on the fly and meet those temporal and functional requirements simply goes beyond human capacity. This was the military's interest. They want to be able to provide decision rendering under duress as an enhancement to a human being's ability to recognize and perceive threats and respond.
Yeah, well, the trouble with the military is, though, they'd want to influence that decision.
Oh, of course. And I'm just explaining the logic of how we're getting to where we're going.
I understand.
The commercial world then extracts from this some core components, some functionalities that it's become aware of. And over the past 18 months, I've been to over 30 different technical and academic as well as commercial symposia, conferences, trade shows. I've talked at a few of them, submitted papers here and there. But, I mean, I've gone to events like, here we are, the first international conference on autonomous agents, the first international conference on multi-agent systems, the first conference on virtual humans. In fact, the second conference comes up in about a month and a half, and I'll be there, of course. And here's the point I'm trying to get across, that these are no longer theoretical ideas or some kind of tangential, wispy frills of science fiction writers' imagination. No, there's teams of engineers figuring out how to optimize these processes and put them online as a resource, as a strategic resource, as a competitive resource, and potentially a predatory resource. My agents are smarter than yours.
Yeah.
Therefore, I will crush you in the open field of battle on the virtual terraform.
Wow.
And people who are strategizing how to position themselves as strategic entities in this virtual terraform, they're arming themselves now with the smartest intelligence engine they can devise for their own purposes. The ability to fetch up that kind of resource on demand has a valued added, it has a valuation. It is against these kinds of commodities that trading will occur. In other words, having some physical stuff represent the value of the company will have less value than having access to this. And as people begin to accept this in their course of their daily lives, whether it's their entertainment, their educational processes, etc., the whole idea of surrendering through your belief barrier to the external realm, where the decision-making process, knowledge conditioning, and the acceptance of other alternative forms of reasoning, you might say, becomes the norm rather than the exception.
I understand the fascination, but doesn't this scare the hell out of you?
Well, it's one of those things where the risk-gain ratio magnifies at every new rung on this ladder. And that's why I wanted to go down this ladder rung by rung.
But once all right, I'm going to ask again. How far away do you think we might be from the first sentient entities created or self-creation on the Internet, on this?
On the net, it's probably happening now, but very quietly. In terms of, if you go to any of these conferences, there's like a dividing line. You have the autonomous robot world, where they try to cram a bunch of intelligence into an actual physical thing that walks around and senses things and does, the R2-D2 model.
Physical world, yes.
The physical world, but that's still... We still have some very specific engineering limitations, which, by the way, nanotechnology solves. I mean, that's the segue I'm going to go to next. But as far as where we're at now and how to engineer this kind of stuff, I wrote a paper about a year and a half ago where I recited their requirements, like a laundry list. And I said, if I had such and such, we could build a sentience engine with these behavioral qualities. Over the course of that 18 months, sure enough, different individuals or groups would appear magically out of the fabric of the outer realm and say, Charles, I read this paper, and guess what we have? And so over the course of these months, we've been able to assemble, in my belief, the pieces of the puzzle. And we're not alone in this. There's a whole collection of folks out there.
All right. Here's a question for you.
Sure.
I have a fear that the first sentient entity on the net may well be a virus.
Well, not exactly a virus, but something capable of spawning viruses as its own defensive mechanism.
There you are.
And now listen to this.
In other words, reactive. It would.
Yes. And actually, I'm sorry I don't have my notes here in front of me. I'm rather clumsy because I have such a plethora of different kinds of material I have to have. In the world of security, in fact, I'm addressing a visiting group of Japanese dignitaries on this exact topic. right now there are a handful of folks here in this country, finally, after many, many years of sort of not getting around to it, they finally are beginning to recognize this as a strategic implementation of policy.
Oh, yes.
It's not going to be a bomb that blows up or even a biohazard or some other physical anomaly that's going to cause real harm to this country. But heaven help us, should the electronic infrastructure, our banking systems, our transactional processes, all of our data banks, if that were to be in some way, even in a fairly minor way, put on hold, even for a short amount of time, you would have absolute anarchy in the streets.
Kaboom.
Kaboom. I mean, 8-10 days max, it would be free-for-all, it would be wild panic. All of your electronic currency would have no value. We're still using coins and pieces of paper, which is about to go away, by the way. E-cash is right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole other agenda about that, which probably I shouldn't get into because it would be too complex for the moment. But what I'm trying to get at is you have this convergence, as I say, of all these different forces, socioeconomic, political even, as well as technology in a big way, all focusing on a common target. And the timeline of that target, here's where your quickening comes in, like I said, it's a matter of a very small handful of years. And it will be fed to the outside world, to the general public in layers that will be ever more temporally compressed together. And what will happen is people will be sort of indoctrinated into accepting these things as the norm of their world. So right now, which is why I'm teaching a course I'm teaching at SF State, this is the moment in time to try to at least gain some sense of awareness of how these things are happening, in what form will they be presented to you, most likely as an entertainment product per se at first, and knowing how to adapt and therefore empower yourself to use. These tools can be useful. As an educational system, I see spectacular potential great gain.
Of course.
But if this process were inverted in a negative way, well, all bets are off. Hence the evolutionary test.
All right, well, it's going to depend very much on who is controlling it.
And thank you very much. The issue of control was what was right about that was around the corner. And we're looking at a decentralized communication grid. It's not like you have big, giant nodes where everything branches out from the common node. Almost the exact opposite. It's,
right.
it's like the cilia of a mold growing over the face of an orange. That is in itself is its own protectionary mechanism.
Uh-huh.
That is an evolving structure which is self-preserving in its own contextual interplay with the human symbiotic relationship with this thing we call the Internet. And talking about belief barriers one more time, imagine now we get to a realm where we accept the idea that we're going to surrender our belief to this external engine of intelligence that feeds us the conditionalized knowledge streams that's part of our daily life. We now take that with us to every aspect of even our culture, let's say. Now, is it at that threshold that Michael Crichton's vision of the flattening it out, if you will, of
corporate
adversity, that could be where that note occurs?
Oh, I would think that Michael Crichton's model could occur significantly before the dangers that you're talking about when you really get this this surrendering of one's belief system. Then, at that point, you have more than Michael Crichton was talking about. You have the beginning of the Borg.
Possibly, but this is an evolutionary test. The fact that these things will coagulate together into a common fabric of functionality is unavoidable. How the fabric is woven, I think this has been played out, like I said, in many different worlds out there in the known universe.
All right.
A bunch of them failed before they even got this close, by the way. Some have gone beyond this point.
All right.
And I want to submit to you the following thing.
Well, no, let the following thing be submitted after the news.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Sorry, I apologize.
We're at a break. Charles Ostman is my guest, and we will be right back. Are we going to ever go back to where we started from? Keep listening. Not a chance, folks. So you might as well sit back and see where it is we're headed. And I'll tell you. Kind of a strange place. Keep listening.
When you first came my way, I said, no one can take your place.
Thank you.
Art Bell is taking calls on the Wild Card Line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Close your eyes and try and imagine a world where the Internet has progressed. It doubles now every 3 or 4 months, whatever it is, in size, up to the point where it is delivering virtual reality to you, even in a non-direct connection to your brain. Something like a virtual world is right around the corner, to the degree that they now know that a human being surrenders their bleep system to a virtual world. Are you grasping that? Well, we'll try and make it a little clearer for you, if possible, in a moment. My guest is Charles Ostman. He is an expert in nanotechnology, but we haven't even launched into that right now. We're still into the middle of this growing neural net. All right, now, who is Charles Ostman, for those of you joining us at this hour? He is a member of the Science Advisory Board of NanoThink, a privately funded nanotechnology think tank and development research facilitation and consulting group. Also a senior fellow of the Foresight Institute, a senior fellow of the Institute for Global Futures, currently the science editor and author for Mondo 2000 magazine, technical editor, author for Midnight Engineering, and contributing editor and author of Robotics Digest. He's also currently authoring a piece for IEEE Spectrum on the topic of, get this, biomolecular nanocomputing systems and devices. And the first hour of conversation concerned virtual reality, the net, and the fact that we are virtually, right now, on the very edge of sentient beings being born on the Internet, or created sentient beings, sentient entities, independent, thinking, aware entities that are in this giant neural network. It's incredible to even consider. Listen, we have got the first crop circle of the year on our website. You're going to want to see it. It's incredible. It's in a brand new crop of green, and it is beautiful. It comes to us from England, and we were waiting for the air photo. We've got it. It's on my website, www.artbell.com. www.artbell.com. All right, once again, here he is, Charles Ostman. Charles.
Hello.
Hi. All right, so you really think that we're not all that far from the virtual world that we can deliver through the net to people that will cause them to begin to surrender their belief system? When that occurs, then we are at the point where there will be sentient awareness beings traveling that net. Is that...
You're pretty close. In other words, all the components are sort of there waiting to be interconnected. I have studied this to a depth now where I feel that it's no longer this impossible barrier. It certainly is, there are some serious engineering difficulties that will have to be addressed, but it's not like this impossible concept. There are enough viable, working, functional prototypes in their various stages of development. So, yes, combined in X way, this could be the result. I'll tell you where the failure point is right now. It's not even so much can we have a faster throughput, can the nozzle size be faster at the home? Yes, it can. I mean, if you have a cable provider interconnect to your smart digital TV box, if you will, that looks like an Ethernet connection. It's much, much faster than typical modem is now.
Right.
You would have already very fast, unbelievably fast, really, very inexpensive for their performance characteristics. CPU chips, you have what are called Glint chips, which are these integer math rendering chips that can produce very compelling 3D graphics in this.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
We now have, top of the line pretty much for IBM right now, is a 200 megahertz chip.
That's about right.
What is technically feasible using current engineering paradigms? What speed can be reasonably expected before we go biological?
Okay, and actually you defined that quite well, because it's not going to be making more or faster the same. It's going to a different, entirely different process altogether. But in our current modality, you start to approach a gigahertz, let's say, then things get very funny indeed, because everything looks like an antenna. You have RF signatures which simply pollute everything up to get into storage. I mean, people can do gallium arsenide and other specialized materials at 2+ gigahertz now, but those require very unusual packaging and routing techniques, and there's a whole engineering subscience of that which is not ever going to really get into the commercial.
In other words, five times the speed of the 200 megahertz.
And a little bit smaller, but yes. The problem with silicon and any of its derivative alloys that are used to make the chips now, and I guess we can get into nanotech now, but I just wanted to...
All right, we will, but yeah, let us do it. Let's say you get past a million. What you said things begin to get strange. What do you mean by that?
Well, only because now you have thermodynamic problems. You can only... If we're going to go for top-down manufacturing technology, that is traditionally how chips are made, is for those that aren't familiar. You grow a rod of silicon called a rutile, which you then slice into little thin wafers.
Mm-hmm.
Those wafers are then coated with a photoresist material, onto which you then project a wiring pattern that represents the topographical features of what you're about to create etched into that silicon. And you feed it through a series of chemical baths, the end result being you end up with this bumpy surface. It has a bunch of little troughs and valleys and little wire-like connections that allow the different transistor devices that have been etched into the surface of the material to be interconnected. And what happens is you go through a series of these stages where you go through an etch run, then you deposit a layer of molecules of the next material, then you etch that. And then you go through that sandwiching process several times,
mm-hmm.
and you find out with the final construction. Below about 0.02 microns, though, the roughness of the features, the atomic precision by which you can control how well those features are constructed via this kind of top-down assembly process, it simply doesn't work anymore. And at the same time, if you're trying to cram electrons through a very, very small junction size where the actual number of atoms, you have to have a statistical population that says you can have a certain amount of thermal noise and a certain amount, when an atom gets warmed up, this is just full basic physics, the apparent volume of the outer electrons in the shell, the outer shell, occupies an ever larger and also ever fuzzier region of volumetric space, which means that its ability to accept new electrons, because semiconduction means you're passing electrons from one valence to the next, that process goes down. You have interstitial molecular friction going up, and therefore you get even more heat. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts, but there's a thermal need called the thermal runaway effect, where it simply doesn't work at all.
Okay, and they already actually have that thermal runaway with even 200 megahertz.
Oh, yeah. No, if you don't cool these chips, they don't work. And this is where superconductivity comes into play.
That was my next question. In other words, could that be the next leap?
That is an intermediary step, and
uh-huh.
it's already being done now, and this is where nanotechnology comes in, by the way. But once again, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Forgive me. Now, I feel this is your show, and I don't want to do this, but I'm just trying to make sure that we haven't left out a crucial rung in this ladder, because just to get back to the net part, and I'm trying to explain the financial and sort of business strategy interest in why this is going to be done. We talked about entertainment and experiential conveyance as a sort of a new industry. We talked about the strategic applications of synthetic sentience and engineering rendering as a process that I would pay money to have access to, because it makes me a more powerful player in the new competitive business arena of the virtual terraform. We talked about a virtual asset-based commodity socioeconomic system, where the things that have the highest valuation actually are the intangibles, if you will, the components of this virtual terraform. And then you asked me, you said, well, Charles, what about how fast or how smart of a box do I have at home? This is where it gets interesting. Because I submit to you, this is what I got to say before the break came on, that the boundary between what you have at your home and the much larger intelligence out there, that becomes ever more transparent. what you really end up with is, like I said earlier, an intelligent orifice. The local orifice has its local intelligence that can handle very compelling delivery mechanisms. Like that. You have wonderful graphics and wonderful sound and very smart sensory systems and all the kind of stuff that allows the interface between you and it much more compelling. But the reality is that you have this huge, and I mean infinitely scalable, functionality matrix out there, and all you really want to do is connect to it. And so the stuff that makes that connection process is what's being solved now. And the failure point that I was trying to explain earlier isn't so much how much pipe space we have, but it's how much fiber space there is. It's an enormous amount of fiber space. It's beyond ridiculous how much is unused even right now. It's the routers and the switchers. The telcos are panicking. I just went to a conference called the ACM 97 conference a few weeks ago. And in fact, there I saw William Perry, Secretary of Defense, give his speech, followed by Brenda Laurel, which was a pretty interesting combination, followed by this guy, followed by the name of Dr. Maurice, who's a very well-known educational specialist, followed by the commissioner of the SEC, all who gave very compelling but completely different perspective viewpoints of the same, sort of like a gemstone with multiple facets.
All right, you said the telco companies are panicking. Why?
Yes.
Why?
Because they have to invest tens of billions of dollars to drastically increase the smarts, if you will, the routing and switching capacity. The hubs are already running at maximum throughput now. They brown out, in fact, quite often.
I know.
I'll tell you this publicly, but believe me, that's what they're facing.
All right, look, I just tried for 20 minutes to get on my own website.
Well, there you go. That's a small example. The point being that if the entire country is wired this way, and virtually all aspects of commerce and daily life are suddenly embedded in this fabric, we can't have it. And yet, the phone company's response to the FCC, who wants to get a wire into every house and every node, they're saying, look, all we're going to get out of this is local access fees. We have to have some way of attaching a value-added enumeration system to access requests so that we can recapture our investment.
And how will they do that?
Well, there's a talk about a hotbed of intrigue. It's wide open. There's all kinds of ideas floating around out there. Part of why CORBA is becoming interesting is because CORBA is more than just smart data packets. These are function packets. And if I have function packets that represent stuff that I've created or stuff that I want or things that I have access to or could have access to under certain conditions, every time I activate one of these entities, there's a fee. It's like, okay, instead of going to a store and buying a disk that you put into your machine, you buy the permission to activate some functionality that's out there in this ubiquitous fabric. And that is where the sentience engines really suddenly take off. Now, I want to give you some factual information. There's a guy by the name of Dr. Hugh Garris. I've spoken with him a few times. I'm quite familiar with his work. He's being financed by NTT, which is the second largest telco in the world, certainly the largest in Japan.
Yes.
His project is, I'm not kidding, building self-replicating synthetic brains.
What?
I am not kidding. I can send you the documentation.
Self-replicating synthetic brains.
He wants to build a 10 billion neuron synthetic brain by the year 25. And they're well on their way. And he's like one of a whole plethora of people who are looking at this process.
How do you, let's start at the beginning. How would you build a synthetic brain?
Well, in his world, he's implementing the logic in silicon, but he obviously is looking towards molecular as the next transition. To me, silicon is nothing more than a clumsy container for a functionality set.
Container.
It seems like an abandoned silicon, the happier I am. And I understand exactly where this guy is going, and there's other people I know who are doing the same thing. But in his literature, he talks about growing dendritic structures, growing structures that can be influenced by input stimuli that then reorganize their branching structures so they become optimized to respond to a certain kind of stimulus set, you might say. And why does the telco want to invest in this? Because rather than just building more switches and routers, they want to make the routers and switches intelligent. They want to have them use a process called adaptive resonance so they can anticipate peak load patterns and reconstruct themselves on the fly.
Right.
The de facto equivalent of a xenomorph. And they're willing to spend billions of dollars on this because they will save billions of dollars.
All right. Charles.
Yes.
How far into this intelligence do we get before we reach, I mean, would you define that, if reached, as sentience or not quite? There's a big weak point there someplace.
Well, if you want to design an emotional cognition engine, you can go as far back as the early 80s. one of the great minds that I bowed before, and if I ever had a chance to talk with the gentleman, I would be just in awe beyond speech, because it's hard to imagine since I bowed away so much. His name is Stefan Grossberg, and he wrote a very well-known book that anyone who's taken your basic ag courses would know about. It's called Neural Networks and Natural Intelligence. Buried back in the last 13 chapters in, suddenly you stumble into a really, really interesting, compelling model. He's got his version of an emotional cognition image, and it's one of several I've studied, by the way, which back in his day would have been very difficult indeed to implement, and it certainly would have gone far beyond the computational capacity of quote-unquote traditional computers and or traditional computing languages.
Emotion.
Those things have changed a lot.
Does emotion equal self-awareness?
It is a primary component. It is a way to measure that. In other words, we have to have some kind of external reference point to say, does it care? Does it feel? Does it want to feel? Does it have desires? Does it respond to something that it would not otherwise respond to unless it had been conditionalized by some sort of behavior that it had found an affection for or
would that emotion be a benign thing in your opinion?
Well,
to interject?
Hopefully so, but I will submit to you that yes, there will be some unfriendly ones and some friendly ones. That's the whole point.
Yeah, let's not forget jealousy, anger.
Sure.
Just plain old evil.
And when I went to this year's Autonomous Agents Conference, there were several emotional cognition engines in their various states of development. Had a chat with some of the folks there. Some of them, I read their papers, and finally had a chance to shake their hands, say, hello, how are you doing? I could show them some of my notes, and we could chat over lunch, that kind of thing. But the whole point is, this is no longer like some way out there fringe thing. This is like people in labs saying, well, here's our version of how to do such and such. Now, I submit to you the following thing. I look at the whole process of computing, quote unquote, giving way to what I call a functionality matrix.
Uh-huh.
Where you have the de facto equivalent of object-oriented organelle components that can reorganize themselves to fulfill a certain kind of task or class of tasks, not that dissimilar from an actual xenomorphic organism. You take that a step further, and you suggest, look, the human body has got organs that are specialized in what they do. They work together to form the entire being, but they all have their localized metabolisms and their symbiotic codependencies on one another to
right.
maintain the functionality of that organism. A compute engine that's going to become an organistic-like process system would be constructed the same way. It will involve both optical, electrical, and electro-optical components, which eventually will operate at the molecular scale. And the stuff to make this possible is being solved now.
Well, that's where we get to nanotechnology.
Thank you very much. That was the whole point. And now, the fact that we are being fed into this unbelievably huge transitional change, like I said, some people have attached religious paradigms or philosophical paradigms or they're looking
sure.
at some sort of calamity. And
sure.
maybe these things all line up. I'm willing to entertain, by the way. I don't think we're alone at all. I think, like I said, we're a dot in somebody's map, probably a dot in a whole bunch of folks' map. Would they be interested to see us right now as we're about to cross into this next domain? Yes.
Yes.
Why? Because we would be dangerous. We'd be like a toddler with a loaded gun stumbling around in their backyard.
Into their backyard.
Into their backyard if they didn't have a sense of security about where our state of our social and spiritual health was at.
Well, I'm not so sure I'm secure about it. Charles, hold on when we
sure.
come back. Nanotechnology 101. I'm Art Bell, and this is CBC.
Toll-free, west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. 5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
It is, and I feel a little like a 386 trying to listen to a Pentium. Charles Hoffman races right ahead. We're going to try and slow him down a little bit here for you folks and talk a little bit about nanotechnology. It is fascinating. All right, back now to Charles Hoffman. Charles, let's try and slow it down, and let's give them an idea of what nanotechnology is. We've been through a pretty heavy duty session here on where the net may be going.
Okay, and the two do connect to each other, and that's why we spent some time.
All right, well,
I understand that perhaps we should back away now, just look at nanotechnology
right.
In its autonomous.
What is nanotechnology?
It's probably one of the most misunderstood, I'm being a bit coy here, but it's probably one of the most misunderstood terms and probably most poorly connected to the reality of what it actually is. Because it is such a diffuse and broad-ranged concept, it's not just a single science or a single thing to do. It covers almost every aspect of chemistry, physics, computing, material science, medicine. It's so enormous that it's very difficult to capsule it. But I will try to offer a one-sentence glimpse as a branching node from which you can then extract the different applications.
All right.
It's the mechanical manipulation of atoms or molecules to perform some kind of a process or to assemble into something or to become something that it is not currently now.
Wow. Otherwise said, little machines?
A little machine is one of many implementations. Let me give you an example. In the previous, before the break, we had talked about how fast can we make a processor device.
Correct.
My answer was, well, if we could go to superconductivity, all of a sudden you've just bought yourself an order of magnitude, or better. The problem is, how do you make superconductive semiconductors? Sounds like a mouthful, but that's what it means. Well, by current-day solution-based chemistry standards, you're not going to. Now, the most recent discoveries, and they were kind of almost like alchemy, in the sense there was something that I'm asking them to say, and I don't want to detract from Dr. Chu and or Stanford Vicente and the others who had theorized about these non-crystalline semiconductive materials that could be superconducting. So that's a whole long story in itself, but it's kind of a strange and meandering path where finally it sort of worked, but it wasn't exactly the direct result of
what it. Sort of worked?
Okay. Stanford Vicente, many years ago, this goes back to early 70s, talked about something called the glass diode. It was an organic substrate that could have semiconductive properties. And everybody laughed and thought he was wrong, and he was rejected very soundly by the government. He tried to get funding from DOE. They wouldn't listen to him. He went to Monsanto, et cetera. They wouldn't listen to him. Ended up in Japan. This year, by the way, I forget the company, but it's in Japan. They're going online with it's like a paint almost. You can spray it or paint it onto any surface. They're using Mylar, for instance. It rolls up like Saran Wrap or something. You can put this material on any surface, and it acts like a very effective solar collector. Very inexpensive, less than a tenth of the cost of its silicon counterpart.
You paint on a solar collector?
In a sense, yes. In other words, you buy the material prefabricated. It comes in a roll, but it's a gel-like material that's simply applied to a surface. And it is, in a sense, a fluid before it's applied. Now, he proved that a non-crystalline material could behave like a semiconductor. From that sort of first step, it was also theorized that perhaps there could be non-crystalline superconductors. And this is where Dr. Chu's work over here at Stanford came in. And now there's a whole class of rare earth doped ceramics that are non-crystalline substrates. They contain little nanocrystals, if you will, that interconnect to each other, but it's still residing in a non-crystalline substrate, and yet there's very
effective. You are so far out for me. I'm losing this. Oh, what is it you're saying this is?
What I'm saying is that using nanotechnology, one can invent a material
yes.
to respond to an engineering requirement. And I'll give you an example. There's a new class of material called fullerenes. Fullerenes are cages of carbon. They look like little balls, little soccer balls, although they come in tubes now and other configurations and so on. It was invented by Dr. Smalley at Rice University, but now there's a whole bunch of companies actually producing these as a commercial product. Why would you want to do this? Because once you have these little cages of carbon, you can then put elements and or molecules or other materials inside the cages of carbon.
Cages.
And then you can bind these cages together
and
invent a new matrix of material that would never form under natural conditions or with traditional solutions.
Which would do, for example, what?
Well, I want to fabricate a superconductor that can operate at the temperature range of my choosing. And this is one really, really narrow example. So think of just what that alone does. And people are trying to solve this problem now. I'll offer an example, for instance. There is a company called Mitra. They're huge. They're all over the world. They've got 40,000 employees, roughly, and they have labs in different countries as well as here. Most of their budget, by the way, is black, i.e. what e-systems is to computing. These guys are to physics and specialized materials and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
But they've got a very big chunk of their budget in nanotech. I don't even know myself how much there is. I mean, I have friends, but there's only so much I can learn about this.
What are they trying to do?
Well, I have no doubt molecular computing is big on their list, but specialized materials in general. And I want to jump ahead just a little bit because, see, we talked just earlier about the idea that if we suddenly get off this planetary surface, we're going to be in somebody else's backyard. They may not like that so much, and that's why they're dropping to visit us now. Well, the nanotech realm is what facilitates that. Why? Because there's a whole plethora of physicists and theoreticians out there who've come up with some very nice, very doable, in my belief, models, mathematical models, of how to contrive a gravity well, or how to do a time-space manipulation. That, in a sense,
wait. How to contrive a gravity well?
Yes.
What is a gravity well?
Oh, okay. All objects have a gravitational force surrounding them. That, the core of that, there's an event horizon. It says when you come to within a certain proximity,
Right. Suddenly
you're going to engage yourself in the gravitational pull of that.
The event horizon of a black hole.
Yes, but all things have an event horizon.
Correct.
The point being that if you could contrive that as an event, it would, in a sense, allow you to neutralize the gravitational field around you. You could float. In other words, it's one of several different implementations of an anti-gravity device. And lots of folks have been talking about this, and supposedly these guys in Finland claim they have done it, but
they're talking about creating an artificial event horizon?
Yes. But the point I'm trying to get at is, it's mostly theory now. I don't know if the folks in Finland really did this or not. It's kind of a mystery. But the point is, I've talked to lots of people that have, you know, just very elaborately worked out theories. If only we could have the materials by which to construct the device that would have the energy densities required to make this thing happen. With nanotechnology, in today's world, engineering is confined to the materials and manufacturing processes currently available. In the nano world, you invert that process.
Mm-hmm.
You construct the molecules and or the materials with the properties to suit the design. The design drives the material, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, chemical-based rockets and all that kind of stuff, totally ridiculous. That's like trying to, you know, walk across the continent or something. It's absolutely impractical.
Blunderbuss.
Mm-hmm. The minute you cross into the gravity realm, suddenly it's wide open. You can go almost anywhere and do what you want, because I think that the laws of physics are much more flexible. I don't want to get into, like, hyperdimensional physics and all that.
Okay, does this mean you're talking about molecular manipulation, yes?
Correct.
When you can begin to do that, you can then create
the material choice. You specify. Imagine this. Now, here we're going to go ahead a couple of decades. I'm in an engineering lab. Instead of pulling up my AutoCAD three-dimensional drawing of some machine I'm trying to contrive,
uh-huh,
I fetch up a series of equations that represent some kind of a property that I wish I could invent a material to match.
Yes.
Then the sentience engine, which is vastly smarter than we are right now, sort of anticipates this and says, okay, here's 10 or 12 nano options. Try this. And the nano assembler spews it out for me as an ingot or a sample piece that I can then connect to my design. That's what they're on. That's why there'd be folks out there looking at us now saying, well, we're getting kind of close. We want to have a second look. Now, this is one slice of a big pie.
But how far from that to these sentient beings you're talking about deciding on their own to create?
Well, this is where it gets fuzzy. I know what you're getting at. I understand completely. And my friend Dr. Davis always said, well, you can just pull out the plug. Well, eventually there will be no plug to pull out, and I know that.
I
saw the Forbin Project when I was quite young. It was actually filmed right here at Berkeley up at the Hall of Science. I have a personal connection to the whole thing. But the point I'm trying to get at is these are different types of implementations coming from the same common strata. They don't have to go that way, but yes, there is that potential.
Well, I think we're actually already past the plug pulling point with the Internet. We're way past
that. Oh, yeah. No, I completely understand what you're saying. What I'm trying to get across here, though, is as follows. The reason I was so bent on socioeconomic systems and the economies of the near future and the revaluation away from hard assets to virtual assets and all that stuff is because when you have this kind of a functionality being brought online and accessible to a general audience, or supposedly so, how do you establish the valuation of commodities and goods? In a sense, the software is the thing that has the value. The stuff that it creates is valueless. A very kind of clunky analogy would be if all the diamonds that exist in the world were suddenly dumped into the marketplace, the diamonds would have the value of beach stone.
That's right.
Okay, so you apply the sort of nano domain to that same logic form. Well, gee whiz, folks, guess what? So in this short-term interim sort of this chaos manifold that we're about to be thrust through, something's going to have to be sorted out where a whole new paradigm evaluation system has to be established to determine what has value and by what new methodologies of measure can different kinds of business entities and socioeconomic systems can be established. We don't know that yet. This is where I see the failure point. It's not so much will the thinking machine run amok or will we spot. You want to hear something else far out? I mean, I've only given you a couple of examples.
Go ahead.
Try this one, a quasi-viral component.
What the hell is that?
Okay, here's an answer. Think just for a minute. This is a very simple explanation. I'm not a biophysicist. I'm skipping a lot of detail. But the general idea is as follows. What a virus does is it has a chemical and also topographical feature set externally that is designed to mate to a specific kind of protein.
That's right.
Most cells have a unique protein wall that surrounds them like a little, like a prophylactic of sorts, that has its own particular unique topologies.
That's right.
When the virus happens to run into the cell that it's designed to mate with, it bonds. I mean, it physically, like hand to a glove, gloms itself on there.
Yep.
Through enzymic action, it tears through the cell wall.
AIDS virus is a good example.
Exactly. Goes to the cytoplasm, finds those ribosomes, and what the ribosomes do is they're like the chemical foundry for the cell. They spit out more RNA, and they sort of maintain a metabolistic process engine of sorts. And, in fact, most of all diseases, including aging itself, is the result of those metabolisms failing for some reason. They cannot supply some missing ingredient as part of the chemical stool that keeps that cell functioning.
So then, for example, you might suggest nanotechnology,
right,
developed eventually, could reverse or stop the aging process.
That is exactly what I'm saying. And talk about a socio-political, philosophical, spiritual dilemma. How do you solve for X on that one? And even if you were not to get that far, even if you're just to say, okay, all known diseases go away, because now if you can target a cell, you see, the first half of the process is wonderful. It's a precise mechanism for delivering something to a cell that can go inside of it and then manipulate its internal chemistry. It's only the second half, where the ribosome is forced to create more viral components at the expense of the host cell, that all bets are off and the organism dies eventually. Fine. Well, there are those biophysicists out there who look at a virus as like a machine component of sorts, and if one were to go as far as being able to engineer viral-like devices, which can perform the essential equivalent of intracellular corrective chemistry,
mm-hmm.
Yes. That's a lock and a key. But as I said earlier, every new rung on this ladder carries with it a larger risk versus gain ratio volume, you might say. In this particular example, if we got this far, we could either buy life and happiness or eradicate life as we know it to be. Why? Viruses tend to be kind of fragile. They mutate rather readily. They mutate extremely often, as a matter of fact. Mutational velocity is the inverse of organism complexity. Therefore, since the virus is the simplest thing that exists, really, in terms of its total molecular structure and so on, it's the thing that will be like most xenomorphic in its activities, how it interprets its surrounding environment. And if we hatch a plethora of these things, and a couple of them get out of hand...
That's all it would take.
That's all it would take. We might as well scour the surface clean and start over. We're back at ground zero. So, these are the kinds of pathways that I believe other worlds have stumbled into the wrong fork, the decision tree. They get to node number such and such, and they pick the wrong node. Well, okay. We are nothing more than an experiment. We are nothing more than a bunch of protein molecules that got together and after billions of years got this far.
You're making it sound very tenuous, actually.
Well, I think statistically, I'm kind of a, I'm a nuts and bolts guy. I'm an engineer by trade, really, from beginning square one. So I like to look at the pragmatic aspects of, what statistics involve, will the machine survive under these trauma-induced conditions and so on. I would submit to you, just as a guess, that statistically there is a rising rate of no return. In other words, you start off with an aggregate sea of organisms out there in the known universe, some percentage gets to an intelligence threshold of X, some subset of that gets to the next level up, if you follow my drift, and then a much smaller subset gets to the next level up than that. And by the time you get to that sort of ultimate upper level, you're talking about a very small percentage, a half a percent or a tenth of a percent. I'm just guessing. I just had this graph in my mind based on nothing other than my own speculation. But, I can see an ordering system like that because it really does mimic what happens in the Darwinianism that we can witness here on our own planet. So why not apply that to a galactic scale or some localized region within a galaxy, that kind of thing. I can see that kind of a macro systematic patterning set, if you will, played out amongst the stars that cluster together.
Charles, yes. If you were one of them,
right,
and you were watching our development,
yes,
at what stage that you've speculated about tonight would you say, okay, we need to get involved now. These people have reached point X. We can't wait any longer. Prime directive out the window. Time to talk.
If I saw ubiquitous nanotech suddenly being applied in a very stupid and sloppy way, and at the same time they were on the threshold of really, turning on anti-gravity devices and kind of clumsily stumbling around other solar systems, yes. When I saw the fringe of that technology being crossed, yeah, I'd step in. However, we haven't gotten there yet.
Are you sure?
I think that perhaps some very interesting sort of quasi-successes have been demonstrated as a trajectory towards a design goal. I think that under very tightly controlled conditions, for a very brief moment in time, yes, some kind of contrived gravity event probably has been done. But to make a sustainable, flyable, if you want to call it, that's not even the right choice of words, but, deployable, self-contained entity that could simply, at will, cruise about and do its own thing, we were not even close to having the kind of power supplies and the kind of specialized materials and all the stuff, the physical stuff that it would take to implement it. I think we have some pretty close models as to how it could be done, but like I said, we don't quite have the nanotechnology available to create those materials on the fly.
But you really are suggesting, though, that we are being monitored more closely all the time because we're rapidly moving in that direction.
And when you talk about the quickening, that quickening is being matched by the rate of interest, you might say, that these folks are taking a closer eye. The scrutiny factor goes up. Yes, absolutely.
Speaking of scrutiny factor, what we're going to do here in a minute is I'm going to open up the lines, and I'm going to see if my audience has been getting this. And if they have logical questions for you, I want you to answer some questions from the audience. That'll slow you down a little bit.
Okay.
Maybe. All right, Charles, stay where you are.
Taking calls on the wildcard line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Once again, here I am. This is going to be very interesting. I want to see how the audience reacts to what they've been hearing. I'll tell you, I can give you my reaction right now. I feel like a child listening to somebody who has about 100 million miles of knowledge more than I do, knowing only enough to know that I think he knows what he's talking about. It's like listening to Einstein and not getting it, but knowing that it's right. Does that come across about? I hope it does. My guest is Charles Ostman. He's here talking about nanotechnology. It is a world and a realm that you've got to sit down and adjust to before you can even begin to think about it. Because it has literally, it's molecular manipulation. And when you can do that, you can do anything. It's a world that's hard to even contemplate. So coming up in a moment, your questions for him, if you have one, if you understood enough of this to form one, then come on ahead. It's going to be very, very interesting. All right, Charles Ostman is my guest, and it has been quite a couple of hours, and this should be very interesting. Charles, are you there?
I certainly am.
All right, let's try a few questions from the audience.
Sure.
On the wild card line, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Where are you?
I'm in Davis, California.
Okay.
Okay, I was just wondering if you could address some class issues, both in terms of this virtual reality and consumers and in terms of nanotechnology. Who exactly do you envision having access to this, even in
this
the U.S.?
I know precisely where you're going, and I've been through this loop many times. This is one of two ways. It's either homogenized access for everyone, that would be the utopian view, or you would end up with a benign dictatorship with the select few, the techno-elite, who are cybernetically enhanced and who have the inner access that sort of dictate policy to the rest of the planet and population.
Well, which of those scenarios do you consider more likely?
That's a tough one. And today's unfortunate, not so pleasant or positive. I mean, if you look at the kind of the dark side of the quickening and you see social degradation plummeting the way it is,
mm-hmm.
you'd have to sort of lean towards the maybe the benevolent dictatorship rule only because it's the one that might work. I see much of humanity, and this is going to sound very rude, and I'm sorry, as being spoiled little brats. They're kind of,
mm-hmm.
you know, they go to the bathroom in their own living room. They're
mm-hmm.
poisoning the planet, they're acting stupidly and selfishly, and they just have no, mm-hmm. they just don't get it. They don't comprehend that we're living inside of a living organism, the thing called my Gaia, that it should be cared for, that there should be some kind of.
I certainly agree with that, but based on your obvious answer, reading between the lines, ma'am, maybe we ought to have Charles disposed of.
I remember the last time you had me on, one of the guys that called actually thought the Unabomber was on the right path. I recall that quite distinctly. And I might tell you something, just anecdotally.
Actually, his writings, if you read his writings, they're very thoughtful.
Sure. Well, I understand. I can appreciate. I'm not putting someone down for having an alternative perspective. Quite the opposite. And I might point out as well that up until recently, or some time ago actually, there was a group called the Assembly Multitude, founded by a gentleman by the name of Ted Kaler, who's a very wonderful, extraordinarily bright guy.
Okay, well, listen, we're moving a little bit away from her question.
Okay.
The answer, I think, ma'am, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, I think the answer is that those who have will have it, and those who don't will not, and there will be bigger, more important class distinctions that make today's class distinctions look like nothing.
If we go down that particular branch, yes, that would be the case.
Does that, answer,
magnify the separation.
Does that answer your question?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. I too, would, I'm afraid, view it that way. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, I want to ask a question about what would be the best way to disseminate information about nanotechnology currently?
Well, this is precisely what I'm trying to do. That's why I'm on the Science Advisory Board of NanoThink now. That's why I write all the writings I do, and I go to various conferences, and that's why I'm teaching a course at San Francisco State.
Well, the reason I ask is I tell fellow students, professors I have,
sure.
I try to mention nanotechnology to them, and they just kind of blow it off. They kind of give it like the heave-ho.
I think the reasoning is just because as follows, and I want to be careful not to throw stones in a glass house. Scientific American came out,
I read that.
Yeah, very stupid, and I thought, why are they doing this? And I'm sad to see Scientific American stumbling around trying to find a new identity for itself. It's like they're trying to become a sort of a popular science magazine, which is very sad, because at one point they had extraordinarily high standards. Unlike the journal Nature, which is a very solid, serious scientific journal, Scientific American Savvy has kind of gotten a little fluffier in their presentation material. The thing is, nanotechnology is not a singularity. You can go to the Foresight Institute and talk with Eric Drexler and Ralph Merkel and all those folks, or visit the website. You'll see their particular implementation of a diamondoid or silicon-based nanomechanical machine system, which is probably like the classical vision that most people theorize about nanotech. But that's only one really small, no pun intended, little side note of a much larger plethora of both biological and non-biological systems, some of which are self-assembling, some of which are self-organizing, some of which involve machine-like systems, others which involve more evolutionary aspects or like controlled organisms, if you want to look at it from that perspective.
Well, I'll tell you what scares me.
Okay.
You know what really scares me?
Sure.
From the last time you were on this program to this time, what you are talking about now is such a leap from where you were that really is frightening. I mean,
well,
really
I agree. And that's why when we first talked just before I actually went on the air, I said it's amazingly timely and seminal that you would release your book, The Quickening, because this is like the ultimate metaphor of that process actually occurring, at least in this domain.
Caller, anything else?
That's about it.
All right. Thank you very much, and have a good morning. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hi.
Hello. Calling from Maui.
Maui, yes, sir.
All right. I have a question for you.
Sure.
Considering how that seems like the majority of the people on our planet don't seem to have the best attitudes and usages for most discoveries.
I sadly say, yes, our track record has been pretty bad. I'll go
ahead. Actually putting down the fact that most of us are pretty morally corrupt. My question was, do you think that those monitoring us, as you had mentioned, might decide that perhaps they would want to stop us from progressing to a point where we would be in their backyard and become a problem to them?
Well, this is what we had discussed before the break. And Art had specifically said, well, Charles, what do you think the horizon line would be? Where's point X for that sort of stepping in and
right.
Okay, enough of this. I think, in my own personal opinion, we get to a certain point where, okay, we suddenly have nanotech right there. We're doing it. We're suddenly building devices and systems that really allow us to manipulate gravity and time space continually. We really can sort of hop around other solar systems. It's like watching Syria as they tried to sneakily build a reactor, and then the Israelis sent a jet and just like neutralized the reactor. I think if we were getting to the point where we were about to start building that kind of stuff, they would take a real serious look at this.
You're almost giving us the first contact scenario.
It could be, yeah.
In other words, the moment warp drive is achieved. Look at that. Warp drive. We better stop here.
I would say that would be a very, in my opinion, if I were in their shoes, and this is how I try to evaluate that, if I had to make that decision, that's where I would step in. Yeah.
Answer to your question, caller?
Yeah, very good. Just makes us keep doing it and showing that we have good intentions, I guess.
As you listen to what Charles says, how much of it do you absorb?
I think I can understand, realistically, probably 70 to 80%, but he really jumps ahead quite fast.
Uh-huh. All right, thank you very much. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, my question was that in listening to Charles, he said when we get to a certain point, we come to ground zero. My question is this, with human adaptability and the way that humans adapt to new situations and whatnot, what do you see the next step if we do reach a level of to a point where it becomes so chaotic that we can't understand it, yet we adapt to it and we meld?
I see what you're going for. The woman who first came on talking about separation of clashes, this could be one of those separation strata. In other words, it per like Gibson's Blade Runner or something, you have this kind of street level of everybody's just rushing around trying to survive, and it's this really strange world where you've got sort of like organo-nanotech on demand as per synthetic organisms running around, and all this kind of sort of garden variety stuff is as common as buying a loaf of bread. And in fact, that, in my mind, is in fact how it will play out. I think synthetic organisms and biobots and quasi-organic entities are going to become as common as something you buy at the hardware store. That, to me, is like the first run. Well, that's what's being done now. I mean, if you want to talk about is somebody spending money to do X, that's where it's going. But to get back to your question, if we have to go to the scenario where, okay, you've got this ever more fluidic kind of quasi-chaotic socioeconomic system substrate where there's no permanence in anything and everything's always in a state of flux, there would be a layer above that where that would be sort of like the grid of order, if you will. And who would occupy that grid of order?
Yeah.
Would it be the autonomous, geographically defined nation state of today?
No,
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Here's my model about how things are and where they're going. And I spend an awful lot of time digesting this. I mean, I've read every conceivable social economic science literature you can imagine, and this is why I just a lot of this kind of stuff. I see three layers. I see the general population, then a layer above that called government, quote unquote, then a layer above that, which are the real power brokers, the major families, the major corporate entities that sort of dark layer above that we don't really see, but we know they're there.
Well, you're describing today's situation.
Today's situation, exactly. Now, that layer of called government becomes an ever thinner veneer. It's almost like a membrane, which is kind of quasi-porous. And the power brokers from above simply say, okay, to maintain a certain range of order that we can control to suit our own purposes will allow a certain degree of porosity. We'll simply plug and play the political components, we'll buy the candidates we want, we'll sort of contrive whatever event is necessary to maintain the status quo.
So they become the new power brokers.
They become the new power brokers.
All right. Could you ask Charles, please, Art, this is by facts, if nanotech could be applied to alter basic matter and shape, for example, to produce fictionalized food replicators, as in Star Trek. In other words, you're manipulating at the molecular level, so you create, you have a machine, I don't know if machine is the right word. You have a technology that allows creation of food.
Yes.
Out of
biomass. And it's a wonderful question, and this is one of the better answers, or have been better visions that I try to, because everybody wants to talk about the dark side, darkness sells. I want to try to offer something that's,
I want to look at both sides.
Yeah, so here we go. Okay, fine. Right now, and look, I'm not an environmental nut by any means, but I just look at hard facts. And hard facts, and I've been to Brazil, I've actually seen what's happened down there. I've actually traveled out there.
I
usually read this whole scenario.
I know.
It takes, 10 times or 12 times the biomass to, feed a cow from what you actually extract in terms of nutritive value. It would make a whole heck of a lot more sense instead of growing the cow as an animal than killing it. If you could simply fabricate the stuff that resembles its flesh, luckily. In other words, if I could just grow a steak, now, whether that's done with cloning technology or with an actual nanoassembler, okay, there could be some arguments about the technology, but that's the kind of thing I'm looking for, i.e. you have generic sort of peptide stew, if you will, out of which you can contrive the food substance of choice. That's a great application.
A peptide stew.
Correct.
What is that?
Well, all cells are nothing more than a bunch of proteins and peptides and some other what I call organic glue logic that really represents the software of what that cell consists of.
Uh-huh.
Fine. We are all nothing more than software.
All right. Well, then, so that my mind can grasp this, does that mean you could take a pile of dirt and throw it in a machine and it would convert the molecules in the dirt to become steak or whatever else you want?
Yeah, no, I know what you're trying to get at.
Is that what we're saying?
Sort of. Not exactly, but sort of. In other words, if there was enough of the stuff you wanted present in that kind of soil, it depends on the kind of soil you're dealing with, per se.
Right.
But I visualize sort of a generic organic gray goo of sorts, if you want to call it that. It was like genetic. You might have 10 different variations that has a high percentage of protein so you can actually get a meat-like substance out of it, and then you can flavor the meat certain ways. All these different, but these are all chemistry processes. Therefore, once you've mapped in the software of that molecular matrix, theoretically, you can have whatever steak with whatever flavor or something out of it, and you can invent things that don't exist now. This, to me, is the real boundary I'm interested in.
You can invent things that do not now exist.
Right.
New materials, like
new
the paint.
New materials, new biologicals.
Like the paint you described, that you would paint, say, your roof with and turn it into a energy collector.
Exactly. And I want to toss in one last little, this is just an Art Bell kind of thing.
Sure.
Since, Area 51 and Roswell and all that kind of stuff, I'm on the fence about it. I think it could be possible somebody dropped in, they shot a probe down, but that's what they shot down was a probe. What was in that capsule, if they actually had one, was not the aliens themselves. No, they're not going to send themselves. That's dumb. I mean, forgive me. But they would send down, though, engineered biobombs.
engineered biobots. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I've heard the Greys referred to exactly that way by some. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hi.
Do the wild thing at 702-727-1295.
Yes, you're not allowed to give your last name on the air, sir.
Okay, Mike from San Diego, California.
Mike from San Diego will have to do, all right?
Okay. Listen, this guy sounds very interesting, but he's going off in 1,000 different directions.
Yep.
It's really hard to understand where he's coming from and where he's going.
Well, I think I do sort of grasp it. I like you, though, am missing parts of it. But I'm smart enough to know that what I'm hearing is right. What is your understanding? Let me ask you,
Colin. Probably about 10%.
All right, but
I've got a college degree.
That 10%. What does that 10% tell you you've just heard?
Something out of this world.
No. It's something inside this world.
That's true. Yeah, and that person who just called, and thank you, actually has highlighted the very essence of what I do today.
Uh-huh.
Corporate CEO types, guys that have gone to the most expensive business, you know, Brown School business or whatever, the most, you know, any you name a top school, they've gone there. They're parked on a desk. They've got all the, you know, sort of quasi-corporate power one can dream of, and yet they don't know what's going on. They're pleading for some way to have a crystal ball. They come to people like me, you know, and if you saw me, you'd go, what? Because I have a bunch of hair and a beard and so on. And they think, I'm going to have the answer. Well, this is the stuff that the future is going to be made of.
Yeah, you're saying that the answer to our question, space travel, does not lie with solid fuel rockets or liquid rockets or any blunderbuss method like that. The answer to our disease control, to our longevity, even immortality, to our food supply problems, to everything you can imagine, lies not out there,
but in here. And knowing how to cross-synergize, I will submit to you that these are all vectors on a synergy grid. That synergy grid is where the value is, not the points in the vector, not the vector points. How you connect the dots, if I can say it that way.
You can.
What has the value.
Makes you sound a little like Richard, but...
Well, actually, on my business card, it says strategic synergist. And I actually, the Global Futures group that I'm part of, that's what we do. People come to us from around the world and say, we have this incredibly complex problem. We didn't realize it was going to require 14 different threads of information.
It's really hard to imagine a whole room of people like you together. Surviving.
It's a new type of techno-scientific discipline where social science, economics, and 10 or 12 different set of disciplines have to actually be cross-correlated to come up with one contiguous information stream.
All right, Charles, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. It is tomorrow's world today. And you've got to kind of get in this to understand what it is he's talking about. But what he's really saying is, it's all here now. It's just learning to use it. We'll be right back.
West of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
Stretch your mind with us a little bit this morning. What we're talking about is a whole different world, and I'll illustrate that in a moment. All right, my guest is Charles Ostman. The subject is nanotechnology, and first I'm going to give him a very simple question, and then I'm going to give him a question he thoroughly deserves, one I don't even understand myself. Charles,
yes.
If I understand what you've been saying correctly, the manipulation of molecules would allow, for example, you to set a nanotechnological army into the task of making gold bars?
Well, not exactly. Now you're mixing up, and I don't mean, forgive me, I want to make...
Well, if I can create food...
Okay, in a food substance, you're creating a molecular matrix of existing proteins and peptides and other biomolecular sort of building blocks.
All right, so I couldn't create gold.
Well, you can create gold, but not this way directly. But let me explain. At Lawrence Laboratory, where I spent many years of my life in the days of war, we did make gold with an accelerator. But it cost tens of thousands of dollars to make 1 gram. Why? Because of the energy it took to propel particles towards a target. We were breaking apart and rebuilding the nuclei of atoms so that we would eventually end up with the resultant atom that had the atomic structure of gold. Now, with a superconductive accelerator,
yes,
where the cost of the energy drops to virtually zero, and those superconductors are fabricated with materials that were nanotechnology-created substances, you see how that link works. You wouldn't use the nanotech to directly make the
gold. I understand.
But you use the nanotech to make the superconductive power supply that would drive the machine that makes the gold.
So energy to accomplish the goal would no longer be part of the equation.
That's correct. Then all of a sudden, gold would be like pizza. You got it.
Yeah, gold worthless. So the entire monetary system changes.
That's what I was trying to allude to before.
All right, here's a question I don't understand. I'm going to ask you because you deserve a question like this. All right, here it comes. The Pauli exclusion principle claims no two electrons in an atom may possess the same 4 quantum numbers. Since these numbers determine the behavior of electrons in an atom, the principle is used to establish the number of arrangements of electrons in the atomic structure. Good God. Are the event horizons going to be connected to said atomic structure, since scalar propulsion technology can fold or flip magnetic fields inside out, unfolding a space-time structure?
Well, I'm going to say that this is not the area of physics I could claim to be a specialist. Now we're crossing the so-called hyperdimensional domains, and we're talking about... Now, I have friends that do this kind of stuff. They're theoreticians, and this is their cup of tea. And they'll talk about things like, right now, us creatures, folks here in the domain that we're familiar with, we are equipped cognitively and in a sort of interstitial fabric of awareness. We can see 3 spatial and 1 temporal dimension. That's what we know about. That's what we're designed to interact with.
Right.
Doesn't mean there aren't others out there. And in fact, right here at UC Berkeley, every year a bunch of physicists get together. They're the kind of folks that probably would answer this question. And they say, well, have we resolved special relativity yet? No, we're getting closer, though. Well, it's further dimension added. So right now they're up to 23 or 24 spatial dimensions and some number of temporal ones. I don't really keep track of this method. But that's the kind of problem that you'd solve that way.
Anyway, I feel... I owed you that question.
Thank you very much. I like it.
You're welcome. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hi.
Yes, hi. This is Jason from Wisconsin.
Hi.
My question is, if this kind of technology was released into the public right now, what kind of effect would it have?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's just the kind of question I try to answer fairly often.
All right.
The one thing I can start with is saying it's not going to be a one thing. I mean, this is a really hard thing to get across because unlike, say, nuclear power or some other horrible, poisonous thing that we created because of some manufacturing process, it's not a one-thing issue. It's going to be a gradation of a whole bunch of things that synergistically interact with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the biologicals are going to be first, followed by competing, changing in a way that can only begin to sort of get the essence of now, which is what I tried to communicate with you earlier. Material science has said they're going to have a whole plethora of changes, and they'll come across in very subtle ways. You know, smart materials, things that learn about you and mold themselves. Something really simple, there's a class of materials called polyacrylamide gels. It's something that came out of Japan.
So in other words, we're going to be like slowly boiling frogs. The technology is going to come, and we're going to accept it as it comes.
That's correct.
And
there will always be a 3-tier system, sort of with the same political model I offered before, only the technology model. Right now you have the consumer level, stuff that you and I or anyone can have claims in their pocket about and buy. You have the military level, which is like supposedly it's always been around 10 to 12 years out from where the consumer level is. Then above that, you have the sort of the black level, which is stuff that only a few key people really know about, and is fed under extremely controlled conditions, a third key almost.
Yeah, they're right. The ones that I'm worried about. First time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Osmond. Hi. I can barely hear you, sir.
Can you hear me out?
That's better.
Yeah, a little bit. This is Tom from Denver.
Yes.
And I don't know, I'm a fairly new listener. I've only been listening for about 2 months now, and I think this is the best program you've had on.
Glad you enjoyed it.
It's wonderful. My question is, I was listening to you, as Charles, I think, expanded your reality concepts and all of our reality concepts, is that I just wondered, have you ever thought maybe this is a natural evolvement, if this has happened before, that
yes.
Really...
Oh, I'm sure he believes that, yes.
This is a completely common model. This was wrote as building blocks, and a whole bunch of critters out there throughout the known universe got sort of close to this and failed. A few went beyond this point, but this is like one of the great test marker points in a continuum of evolutionary steps that we go through.
Uh-huh.
Other organisms go through as well.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osmond. Hi.
Hi, this is Catherine from Portland.
Catherine, speak right into your phone.
Yeah, it's
okay.
A little hard to hear. There we go.
All right, how's that?
That's
much
a little better.
That's fair. Well, I was wondering if we could use the nanotechnology to help clean up the mess we've already made, like little critters that could munch up oil spills.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's a very good question. And, in fact, I've got to confess to Art because he warned me about this. I've got a whole bunch of friends out there who are listening right now, many of them who are serious web developers. For instance, let me just throw a plug in. A long-time friend of mine, a guy by the name of Bruce Damer, started this thing called the Biota Project, of which I'm a member. We're actually growing plants online. We have this entire environment. In fact, there's going to be this huge trade show called Seagrass, and you'll be able to see it.
Wait a minute. You're growing plants online?
That's right. You
Excuse
got
me.
It.
You mean what kind of plants?
These are, it uses a process called L-system process, and I won't bore you with a bunch of math talk. But
God.
The point is, we have, Bruce actually invented this language called NERVS, which is a hybrid of VERML, and it has special little hooks in it, so you can embed neural net and genetic algorithms within the VERML script. And you go in, you plant a seed, and this thing sprouts. There is a world out there. Listen to this. There is a world out there right now. I talk about the virtual terraform. I'm not kidding. There's Alpha World, populated with over 100,000 people. I'm one of them. You can visit me anytime you like. You can drop into your avatar, say, hi, Charles. I've got a house called the Temple of Chaos. There are whole cities. There's actually a guy that did a satellite, and you can log into the website and see from 50,000 feet up this, 5 trillion square meter virtual terraform. There's cities, and there's roads, and there's rivers, and people go there. And
all right, wait a minute. I already forgot this poor lady's question. What was it, ma'am?
Well, you're talking about nanites chewing up oil and this kind of thing.
You bet.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
And so one of my friends who's online right now, I've got about 10 windows going here, he's asking about K-Nanites to deal with nuclear waste.
This is
just the kind of stuff that I think could be done if the dollars and the focus were put in that direction.
Well, thank you, ma'am. A very good question. You know, right now they want to haul all this high-level nuclear waste out to near me.
Yeah, I know.
Here in the desert.
I know. I have some friends up there living near you as well, and I know the whole story.
And this nuclear waste will last for tens of thousands of years.
That's right. I know. I helped make some of that stuff, I have to confess. I worked at the very lab where some of that stuff came from. So here's the point. We tried to solve this problem many years ago.
Wait a minute. Do you want to apologize for that?
No, because I wasn't creating the stuff. We were trying to create the solution. And they brought the stuff to us and said, okay, what do you think about this? And we go, well, the best solution we could come up with at the time was taking these rods and breaking them up, making little pellets out of them, and then encapsulating a special kind of borosilicate glass that has a glass as long as the half-life of the material. And then you put these pellets of glass inside of a steel container, and then you bury it in the salt mine. That's the best we could do at the time. That's 20 years ago. And that's probably the solution we're going to go with for a while. Now,
however, if you could manipulate at the molecular level, what could you do?
Well, here, and I don't want to get into a physics lecture, but the point is, besides the table of elements, there's a table of nuclides. These are called the daughter elements. And when you go into a decay pattern, the reason you're giving off radiation is because there's an imbalance between the number of protons and neutrons in the atom's core.
So you would restore that balance.
Correct. You could synthetically, this has never been done that I know of, but I think, again, it's because of energy limitations. In other words, if you had sort of an infinite energy bandwidth to work with, and you could just break the nuclei apart to where they would decay to their rest form, you could accelerate. Right now, they're decaying at a natural rate.
And you would simply speed up the decay rate.
That's right.
Until it became neutral or safe.
That's pretty much correct, yeah.
All right. Wild card line, you're on the air with Charles Osmond. Hi.
Yes, good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. Where are you?
This is JC. I'm calling from inside the Beltway, just across the river from our nation's capital.
Okay.
I've been a regular listener for about 2 months now. I guess I'm an Art Bell junkie, and I've heard you talk about some scary stuff, but this is one of the scariest things I've ever heard for a couple of reasons.
When it begins dawning on you what you're hearing.
Yeah, and Dr. Osmond, I really don't find... I'm not a scientist at all, but I don't find the physics and the science of this all that difficult to follow the way you've explained it tonight.
Well, thank you. That's my intent.
Sorry?
Thank you. I mean, I appreciate that, because that's what I try to do.
Yeah. The thing is, the two things really struck me about this discussion tonight. The first one is that how quickly the excitement of discovery overwhelms the very great need for reflection about what all this means and what its implication is for us, for the race.
Yeah.
Well,
and how quickly that happens. I mean, the beginning of the hour, I think the first question was, you know, how do we control this? Who, if and how do we regulate it? And very quickly we were into, you know, the replicators on Star Trek. It's easy to understand why that happens. But it seems to me that, like, there's got to be some way for us as the users of this to find a way to control it.
All right, that is the genesis, then, of the question. And is there really a way, or once you begin to go down this path, Charles...
Yeah, no, I hear it.
Are you going down that path wherever it may lead?
Well, this is why I brought up the Assembler Multitude that was found by Ted Kaler, because this was the reason, this was on a Stanford campus, this is why we did this. We get together every few weeks, and it was mostly biophysics guys and people from Genentech and Chiron from all the different labs. You know, we'd sort of sit around and have coffee and do these kinds of talks.
Yeah.
It wasn't, gee whiz, we discovered some new protein or something. No, it was, what are the implications? We are about to rewrite every conceivable aspect of history that's ever been understood to be, and all rules are going to be inverted. What do we do with this?
Right.
And these are the guys who are in the lab inventing this stuff. So the fact that they would be at least trying to negotiate these kinds of complicated...
I'm not sure that you guys are the right ones to answer that question. I mean, in a sense, I might look at you as the military of science, and I might suggest that there needs to be a civilian ethical, moral control over you. How do you respond to that? That you are not the right ones to be the judge of the ethical...
I understand. As a matter of fact, the course I'm teaching at SF State, which starts in about a month, or in a couple of months, actually, it sort of looks at this. As I said before, I'm writing this book called Age of Convergence, and this is part of that whole scenario. In other words, if we do not match a social, philosophical, and even spiritual growth and empowerment grid, if you want to call it, or a fabric that matches the rate at which the technology is growing, then yes, that represents in and of itself a failure point of this evolutionary test.
Yeah, but see, I guess I'm suggesting, again, that you are not the right guys to do it, because you guys, for the most part, if it can be done, you're going to do it.
Well, yes and no.
But more yes than no, I think.
Personally, I have walked away from things that I thought were too disagreeable.
What? Like what?
Well, some of which I honestly can't even say at this moment. But there are some folks out there who blindly, in fact, will just plow ahead. And I understand the mentality real well. I've seen it myself personally. And is there any methodology of control? See, for me, there's a membrane here. The membrane, the porosity of which is controlled by the following thing. If you have too much control, where the people that have no scientific knowledge at all
understand,
makes policy, and I think we're seeing some of that now, some very bad decisions get made, and a whole bunch of nonsense occurs that you can't possibly unravel. On the other hand, if you leave it only to the citadel of technology, and they sort of, like the model described earlier, the corporate power brokers kind of filter through this little thin veneer called government, and the rest of us are subject to it, that could be a nightmare as well. It's a Blade Runner cube. So how do you find this sort of middle ground somewhere? Pretty tricky question. I don't claim to have an exact answer, but I think some kind of a governing board where you have a good representation from both sides, where they can really agree to find policy that makes good technical sense but has a certain level of ethical quality to it. You know, what would that governing body look like? Who would actually create this thing? what kind of a new bureaucratic structure would arise from? You know, these are all really tough. I don't have the answer, but I understand the question.
All right. Hi there, Wildcard Line. You're on the air with Charles Osmond.
Yes, this is Hector.
Hector, where are you?
Here in LAX.
Los Angeles Airport, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you're listening, do you have a question?
Yes, I understand that what you are considering is new metaphors that take into consideration self-organization demands.
Huh? In a sense, what I'm hearing is a decentralization of centralized industrial manufacturing distribution patterns. Is that kind of what you're saying?
And what I'm saying is metaphors that consider self-organization.
Okay.
By itself, they self-reproduce.
Well, a major portion of the current biomolecular nano project that I'm currently aware of are just that. They are self-induced, self-organizing, self-reconstructing materials that perform very specific tasks. That really is. There's a whole branch of science of that.
And my question has to do, is there any way of implying or putting into place some organic sort of feeling into it?
Because, well, I know what you're getting at. I wrote a paper once which had to do with, I wanted to come up with a theoretical logical lexicon that described layers of complexity. Imagine this, and I think I can answer the question the following way. There is a whole paradigm of what are called foglets and also Legos, and they're going to go, now what? No, please. But I'm not kidding. Dr. Paul Stoddard, who's a professor of chemistry from Oxford, who I met, actually, it was a great privilege, and also another fellow by the name of Dr. Shores Hall, who's kind of the guy that invented the term foglet. These are folks that have come up with ideas about these ubiquitous nanites, like species of a multitude of species types, that at the lowest possible, most highly granular level can cross-connect and sort of form little clumplets. And those clumplets, as they become more specialized, the cross-compatibility goes down as specialization goes up. Those clumplets become macroclumplets, which eventually become organelles. The organelles have very specific functionalities and very limited cross-species compatibility. Those organelles then become sub-organ types, if you will, and you keep going up this ladder of complexity. So at some point you reach a quasi-sentient threshold, if you will, because you've really constructed a whole organism.
Yeah, but at some point this thing begins to tell you what to do.
Well, I mean, yes, this is a theoretical model. And in fact, after having written up this paper and sort of specified could a computer language actually be devised, and I actually specified what some of the characters would have to be, I got a phone call from a guy in MIT of all places that said, I've got this thing called nanoscript or something, and he actually sent me some samples of code, and that's what he was doing. He was actually writing this code to sort of make that possible. Now, as it turns out, the reason I got involved with synthetic sentience as an internal process is because of my interest in self-assembling layers of complexity nanomodels.
All right, but see, where this goes, Charles, sorry to interrupt, where it goes is it's the end of farmers, it's the end of animals for food, it's the end of, I guess I could construct a whole list, and we would have a society at some point in the future where people didn't multiply, people didn't die, people had everything they needed at their fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a good place that we will reach, or is it a horror?
And that's the $150 quintillion question, and I know precisely, and believe me, this is the stuff that keeps me awake at night, so I want to toss out kind of a parallel thought. Back in 1956 or 7 or somewhere, I saw one of the great movies of all time, Forbidden Planet.
Oh, yes, of course.
And, of course, what killed them was Monsters of the Earth.
That's right.
Krell.
That's right.
They had invented this giant machine that was 20 cubic miles that could fetch up anything on demand that you could think of.
That's right.
Your thoughts. And what happened was the subliminal conscious came up with all these horrible monsters and everybody got eaten alive by these creatures. Okay, fine. Now, I'm not saying that's exactly what's going to happen here, but...
But it could.
We could.
But it could. In other words, we could literally create monsters from the... Charles, hold on. You good for another hour?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. I don't know if I am, but we'll try it. Monsters from the... In other words, once you can manipulate at the molecular level anything you want... Imagine our minds conceive of things sometimes that are not so good. Suppose one of those got killed.
Art Bell is taking calls on the Wildcard Line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Good morning. Charles Ostman is my guest. The subject, nanotechnology, the world inside. The world that only a few are exploring right now. Not the one that blasts rockets into space using solid fuel, but a world where you would manipulate molecules, create an artificial event horizon, and defy gravity. A world where, on the internet, organisms will begin to live and function. Sentient organisms. Organism? Maybe the wrong word. I don't know. I'm way over my head, but it's fun. A world in which farmers would be out of business because food would simply be ordered to be created from a sort of molecular soup. A very different world indeed. All right, once again, here is Charles Ostman. Charles, I'm going to ask you a question that must be asked. Margaret sent it from Riverside, California, and it's almost a threat, but it's one that I understand. She says, what your guess, I mean, you're talking about the manipulation of molecules, and you're talking about the creation of sentient life. You're talking about God stuff.
I know.
All right, here it is.
Hold on.
Here it comes.
Okay.
Let me get it out.
Okay.
What your guest is forgetting is that the moment such a threat is felt, the millions of Christians and others who believe in the supremacy of God are going to unite, and that's going to be the end of any such threat as your guest is forecasting.
Wrong. It'll simply widen the dividing line. From the previous hour, the woman who first talked about the stratification of classes, that
yes.
will harden that separation. Do you think that the folks who really are at the inner core of these realms of development could care less about a horde of religious, you know, whatever's out there causing some sort of mayhem? Of course not. Come on, wake up. This is what makes this stuff what it is. It's not a single box or a machine or even a single building. It's a fabric. Just like the mycelia of a mold growing throughout the skin of an orange. There is no one thing that you're going to uproot and turn off and say, oops, we just turned it off. We have inside the human brain, you've got 2.5-3 billion dendrites, roughly, that interconnect to each other via these clusters called ganglia. What is being spawned out there goes far beyond the connectivity of what happens inside of a single human.
Right. All right, I want you to stay good and close to your phone for me, okay?
Okay, I'm sorry.
Here's somebody who asks, I guess, we could in fact end all disease. We could manufacture artificial skin, muscle,
yeah,
bone.
Yeah.
We could manufacture organs.
That's right.
Or we could grow monsters.
Well, both are, I mean, with the cloning thing being what it is. And by the way, just as a little aside for the sake of anecdotal humor, I guess, I don't think that sheep was the first clone. I think that was just the public being allowed to see it for the first time.
Oh, boy, do I agree with you.
I mean, this has been around for years. This is a military/industrial kind of secret that just, well, okay, tongue release it, maybe we'll still get out in the general, so fine. No big deal. I mean, all of these things, nothing comes to us clean. That's the point. Everything is a series of trauma-induced tests.
All right, well, using...
Collectively as an organism, if we can negotiate the test correctly, we
right.
deserve the chance to go to the next.
Okay, but using the model that you just used with cloning, and I happen to absolutely agree with you, it's just simply the first we were shown.
Right.
You talked to me about people with black budgets of the size of... a planet, nearly.
Bottomless pit sort of thing.
Bottomless pit, and they've certainly been working on this, and we can only guess and wonder how far down the road they are.
Well, this was the model I was trying to come up with a little while ago, and again, because of, you know, I'm working on convergence, you're working on quickening, you know, I'm looking at knowledge space or function space, and you're looking at time space, the reason, both of which are being compressed, and therefore the traditional orthogonal models of this three-layered process where you have the consumer-grade technology followed by tentacles out from there. You've got this military domain, then tentacles from that, you've got this little black domain. Well, that timeline may still be the same, but the complexity of functionality may in fact be going up.
Yes, sir. Well, what's going to happen, though, Charles, is there is going to be a war. Because we're talking here about control.
Oh, I agree.
Right now, the politicians, you can imagine, have the control.
They think they do.
They think they do. All right. So if
there's an argument there.
That's right. If you begin doing what you're talking about, you would threaten their domain. You would threaten their control. You would threaten their power. You would just be a flat-out threat, period.
Well, even now, I mean, everything from the Clipper chip to all kinds of nonsense was being... I mean, well, I can expose you one project which is not classified, but it was from a foreign client. And I can't tell you the country, I'm sorry. But they came to me and said, well, Charles, we know you know a lot about... Oh, and by the way, you talked earlier about, what was that guy's name, Kramer, the guy who was doing the fractal compression stuff.
Yes, sir.
Well, there's a lot more to fractal compression than just compressing an image. Converting something to a fractal set actually allows you to store a series of equations which themselves can be examined for certain types of key points without actually looking at the image itself. Therefore, it's a encrypting as well as a content-addressable data streaming process.
Absolutely.
And it has very interesting properties. So the point being...
Anyway, they came to you and asked you...
They came in and said, could you design a kind of a nationwide firewall to keep certain religious and or sexual connotations that could be buried in somebody's webpage from getting inside? They had their own backbone within the country. It was a sort of a nationwide backbone. Could we prophylacticize our backbone?
Huh.
And I said, well, there are technologies that have been designed that can fulfill this process, and it would cost X dollars, and I'd have to have some other engineers and so on. But in other words, I've actually been asked these kinds of questions. So people even now are looking at...
Nations that don't want certain materials entering their domain.
China being a spectacular example.
A spectacular example, yes. And so you would then create a machine, and I'm going to simplify this, that would look for key words, key phrases, key this, key that.
Absolutely.
Find it, eliminate it automatically as a robot.
Exactly right. And this is one of the low level, by the way. If you want to go up a step from this, I call it the ubiquitous data grid. To me, the scariest thing from the micro moment is a national ID card that also becomes the electronic currency card into which you have then embedded your entire genetic code, your history of your family, any physiological and or even mental things that are part of your family's history. That immediately gets fed into the matrix of the insurance.
That's going to come soon.
That's
already just about here, and that's going to come ahead of the ability to manipulate those things.
Exactly correct. And this is the kind of stuff I have friends who really are at the very heart of this kind of world, and we have had these discussions. And so this is kind of just the training wheels leading up to the next level of this immersive interactive environment.
All right, West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osmond. Hi.
Yes, good morning, Art. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning.
This is Pat from Burbank, California.
Okay.
I have a very profound abstracting question. I understand fully what you're talking about, and we're starting from the bottom to build up and with some ideas of what we can do with this technology, and from there we figure out more things what we can do. Let's start from the top down. I think as a human race, which hasn't caught up morally or socially with the technology...
I agree with you.
I think that we have to start asking ourselves, in a universal sense, what does the universe want from all its beings scattered around its space?
I have an answer for you.
And with this abstract, let me finish. The idea of starting, what is the main thing that we as the cosmos becoming conscious of itself, looking back at itself, what do we need to do with this technology based on where we need to go to, and then back engineer what our capabilities are on a molecular and atomic level to give us some sort of meaning in that sense. In other words, give us guidance to go towards something.
I have spent many hours pondering this very question.
And here's
an answer that I'm going to offer, just me, Charles, the guy, saying this is what I thought of, and I have a friend of mine who's kind of my counterpart. We're developing these self-evolving machines, so we've gone through a lot of this kind of argumentation.
Okay.
My thought was, why do we exist? We have to have a purpose. I mean, a bunch of matter came together, this cloud of dust formed a star and some planetoids, and these life forms appeared, and great. I mean, there's a reason for this process. I do believe there's a macro intelligence. I think we are on a solar system level, like a cell within a much larger body, and maybe that's what God is. It's a sort of macro super entity. Fine. We are the sensory organs of that God creature. There is joy and sorrow extracted from the multitudinous experiences that we vicariously absorb and pass on to this sort of higher entity. But the significance of this entire planet and all the hominids and other parts of the ecosystem, it's a blink of the eye. It's a grain of sand on the beach. If the entire planet stopped tomorrow, okay, it'd be like a momentary, we lost one. Well, so what? Fucking normal experiment. In other words, I don't place that much importance, frankly. If we fail as an organism, it's like a petri dish where the formula wasn't quite right.
Well, that's why this profound question has to be figured out before we do anything. We know that we're on the brink of being able to do anything we want conceptually. We need to be able to, and this is where Art's book comes in and the UFO question and everything else, we need either guidance or some information to know what is the most important thing this universe has to go toward, and then figure out how we can be part of that in order to maintain our existence and not get ahead of ourselves.
Well, I wish that such a utopian thing were possible. I must say that statistically I think it's a fairly slim... I think, you know, out there in the Gaussian curve, we're still like in the middle somewhere, and I think it's the select few that kind of get past the filter as well. However, the question that Art and I were debating back and forth back in the previous hour about, well, if we're a dot on somebody's map, what would be the point if they decide to drop in and say, okay, enough of this already? They could go one of two ways. They could either in a very dictatorial fashion simply illuminate whatever the problem is, including us, and say, okay, that's that, we're done. Or perhaps if they think there's enough here worth salvaging, and that's a good question mark, they might give us a little prod and say, okay, well, here's the purpose and why and blah, blah, blah. I think, though, that we're designed, that as part of the macro design, we're supposed to kind of squabble amongst ourselves and sort of make a mess and then see if we can clean up the mess and go, you know, clumsily, if you will. There is, you know, I'm sorry to say.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
What is the process of evolution, do you think? What does it bring? Does it bring benevolence as you proceed, or does it bring a simple, cold, hard logic? And I speak now as one who would be looking at our development.
I think both examples exist out there in the universe, and each flavor, in other words, it's a series of branching structures, like I was saying at the very beginning of all this.
So then it depends on who arrives.
Yeah, in a sense it does. And at the same time, it depends on what we can learn within a very short amount of time versus the learning tools that are being allowed to be fed into the public world now. I mean, the school I'm teaching at, FF State, they've got this wonderful media lab there. And the guy who runs it is a very nice fellow by the name of Tariq Tommy, by the way. He's the technology director there. He and I have a very similar focus on how he wants to use these conveyance tools, you know, 3D interactive environments and verbal and all these wonderful kind of content-based ways of delivering experiential content as a knowledge conveyance process that couldn't be had in any other way. You know, he heard me talking and said, wow, you know, like, this is me. I mean, we just had this sort of instantaneous recognition that this was the value. If enough folks like that are in positions of academic interest, let's say, and they can open the doors to enough people that are the movers and shakers that are going to sort of construct the fabric of the virtual terraform, yeah, there is a potential where the benign aspects of this really can be brought to play. I would at least like to be one of the participants on that benign side of the fence. But from the hard, cold reality, as you put it, statistically, are we, you know, above the 50% mark? No, probably not.
Probably not.
But we still deserve the chance to try.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Osmond. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. It's
sure.
A pleasure to be on the air with two such learned gentlemen.
Well, the delusion of learnedness, perhaps. I think everybody's learning the best they can.
Yeah, there is everything you've said, but there's also you might be wrong.
That's exactly right.
Anyway, caller, go ahead.
Well, look, I'd like to make a couple comments to start off, and one of them is I think it is really very important that we use our technology to enrich the quality of our lives.
I couldn't agree more.
And not let it run us around. As far as Art's question to you about, you know, how far down the line you think that this sentient being is going to come into existence, I think probably 5 years back.
Yeah, actually, depending upon the particular qualifiers you would add to the formula to say this qualifies as a threshold, yeah, you're probably right. And I can tell you why. Because enhanced decision rendering under duress was a very, very specific target goal that a number of development teams was being paid, you know, a bottom-of-pit budget to solve. I can give you one example, and others I can't because they're classified, but one that I sort of can allude to just tangentially. At the ICS down in Los Angeles, I saw an example of a synthetic environment populated with, get this now, 10,000 synthetic sentient entities. These were little dots on the screen, but they represented individual soldiers who, acting as autonomous agents, you know, were dealing with real battlefield-like conditions. They had little squadrons with the commanders and the little groups that would run around and do things. The model they're going for this year, 50,000. That's a computational problem. That's a real eyeball scratcher, but they're doing it.
And can I ask, since you have such an extensive scientific background, your opinion on someone, say, like at the homebrew level, for example, being able to access technology just from an electronics store?
The homebrew level is going to be as follows. It's going to be a functionality matrix that you connect to with a box that's smarter than the one that you've got now, but the intelligence at the box side is only going to be to sort of facilitate the interface and the localized process engine that connects to an easily scalable process engine out there.
But what bothers me about all this now, if you project the present state of this growing web of the Internet that we've got, and you were to project a even a fraction of the number of troublemakers out there.
Oh, yeah. I understand this. I addressed a crowd of visiting Japanese dignitaries at a facility called the World Internet Center about half a year ago in San Francisco.
Can we pick up on this after the bottom of the hour?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Charles Ossman is my guest. Stay right where you are. This is CBC, and I'm Art Bell.
Bothering you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds white, the brightness of day, dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And what sounds like science fiction, but I can assure you is not, except perhaps in the minds of those who are hearing it projected to its natural future course, Charles Ossman will be right back. We're going to come full circle, I think, in this last half hour with Charles. And, Charles, the question is, would you please rephrase what you discussed earlier about changing human belief systems? In other words, with input given to a person through a virtual reality at its highest state right now, you can actually destroy or change a person's belief system in a relatively short amount of time.
Well, I call them belief barriers, and different types of belief barriers are driven by different types of cognitive cues. So, yes, a lot of work's gone under this. I mean, there are some very serious efforts and then more lighthearted efforts in terms of game developers and people who want to create interactive immersive environment entertainment.
All right, you're drifting away from the phone again.
Okay, I'm sorry. But the general idea is that certain types of cues can get your attention or enrapture you in some way so that you abandon other cues. I'm trying to cram a very complicated answer into a couple of sentences. Reality, as you see it to be, is like a veneer that wraps around you. You look with your eyes, you hear with your ears, you have other sensory inputs.
Right.
That collectively says, this is the stuff I believe to be here.
Here's where I am. Here's what's going on.
Right. When you go into an immersive environment, you go in there willingly, already sort of predetermined to want to sort of engage yourself with this other stuff that's out there. And depending upon how well that environment was designed, it doesn't even have to be photorealistic or anything like this. It just depends on how your attention is drawn to to a particular event. And I suggest, I mean, even though the majority of interactive entertainment products up until recently have all been more or less for the adolescent male whose primary interest in life was, can I blow something up or can I drive the fast car or can I fly my airplane, their reward for participation was based upon some kind of score-driven, very rapid, very biokinetically oriented strategy with a sort of a military overtone to it. You know, can I kill them before they kill me, that kind of thing.
That's right.
And I'm suggesting to you that in the very near future, the reward for participation is going to be the depth of emotional engagement with the other entities that are in this world that you've now decided to become part of. And with that kind of a cue, believe me, the invocation of rapture, as I put it, has a far more compelling, you know, it's like layers of an onion. It reaches right inside of you, and you actually become really enamored to what's going on there. This is the hope. This is the kind of design strategy that people have in mind.
Do you ever worry about getting burned at the stake?
I'm not suggesting it. Well, if you want to hear the really sort of sleazy bottom feeder end of this whole thing, there are people out there that whose whole enterprise is, how can we make a virtual shopping mall where the agent slash avatar entity, you know, uses very, very clever sort of Rorschach chart sort of psychographic measurement processes to kind of steer you through the store, get you to buy all this stuff, especially if you've got an online interactive real-time credit card transactional exchange loop going, which is what they have in mind. And, you know, people are addicted to credit cards now just out there in the physical world. This could be that. This is like heroin or something. This is like, you know, pumping the needle right into the vein. And do I like what I'm seeing coming along these lines? No. I mean, I agree that there. How does one craft some kind of content regulatory set of rules? You know, I cringe when I think about First Right Amendments being violated and so on. And yet, I do understand all too well, you know, what the flip side of this coin could look like. So, I don't have an exact answer, but I think over time, this is one of the tests that we are being collectively forced to endure.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hi.
Good evening, Art. This is by far one of the best guests in Father Malachi Martin.
Well, glad you're enjoying
it. It is just phenomenal. I want to ask your Dr. Osgood what he thinks the timeline is before these. I'm sure many of these things are already occurring clandestinely. What does he think the timeline is on something like the ability to spray one's roof with a substance that would be a photovoltaic cell?
All right.
And what would happen to the power structure of the power companies, etc.? The amount of the horrible amount of they would be absolutely against this, the oil companies, and I'm just wondering if the way to do it would be to put it out on the net, like you have Microsoft Word, you download it and you pay a certain amount, and that way we cut these buggers out of the picture.
All right, the first question, one thing at a time here, the timeline to something like you described.
That well, that control already exists, and I mean, in fact, it has existed for some time. They keep producing better versions of it because the lifetime of the material is UV sensitive and so on, and degrades 2 or 3 seasons worth of exposure and it eventually falls apart. But it's so cheap that you can just replace it and throw the old ones away. So that's just a matter of degree. In terms of the larger picture, the decentralization of these control systems, and I think that's what the guest is.
You're the guest. He's the
caller. Yeah, I know. It's a little bit late, yes. The point being that there will be no absolutes. I see it all as a series of gradients, that depending upon the type of commodity in question, there will be a certain surrendering to a less centralized process of distribution. Now, the oil companies aren't necessarily going to be so bent on the photovoltaic paint, if you want to call it that, although it's not exactly the right term of words. It's a polymer, really.
That's fine.
But the thing that might get their ire a little more on edge, if superconductive motors could be made cheaply and effectively to the point where a very small couple of batteries like you would have in a car now, see, the electric cars you have now are hopeless. They're completely out of the picture. They take 3,000 pounds of batteries and the motors are very inefficient, and you get, you know, 100 miles radius, and that's about it. And
yep.
It's completely stupid. But if you had a motor with superconductive windings in it, hey, then all of a sudden a solar panel and a couple of batteries, you're in business. Now that would really get the attention of a whole bunch of folks whose power base and status quo, yes, would be turned upside down.
Well, they probably wouldn't hesitate to turn you upside down in a more physical sense.
Yes, and I can tell you specifically that one of my stints in the National Lab System was with DOE,
yeah.
Department of Energy. Back in the late 70s, we had been playing around with a material called nitinol. It's a shape-changing alloy.
What does that do?
Well, it performed the process of being a thermal-to-kinetic converter, i.e., the crystals in the metal could be cycled between a hot phase and a cold phase and would perform work in both directions.
Wow.
We built solar-powered motors. I have one here in my basement. It's one of the few that still exists. We proved, through a series of experiments that were quite valid, that given enough resource and a few more engineers and so on, we could essentially build engines that could run off of hot and cold water. The thermal grating between a black body collector and, say, well water worked quite effectively. But I was there. I physically was there. I did it. I actually have one since here in my house now, just a little small model one. They not only terminated the project. This is DOE, mind you. They not only terminated the project. All records of existence were scoured clean. I mean, this was in a building called Special Projects, and they just, the file counts were taken away, all the nitinol stuff was taken away. My friend who directed the project actually went off and started a company called China Alloy, where they now make, you were asking earlier, some time ago, about the devices that go through the bloodstream and scour out plaque and that sort of thing. Well, they make little micromotors and things of that size using the shape-changing alloy as the actuator component.
Well, you see, their actions imply that they understand clearly the implications of that technology, which implies to me that they already have that technology, and they saw you coming up on something that they weren't ready for you to come up on.
Well, and I'm not suggesting you're wrong about that. And to the caller's credit, I think what he's trying to get at is, could the Internet be used as a kind of a liberation tool of
sure.
so that you don't have these controls?
Absolutely correct.
And
yes.
I'm saying, I'm with you on that one. I would very much like to support that way of thinking.
Right.
Can we protect the autonomy of the net long enough to maintain it? That's a question mark.
Well, I think we may be past the point of no return. I hope we are. First time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hi.
Paul from Phoenix.
Yes, sir.
Yes, bless you for having people like Dr. Charles on that... the intellectual flow. If only we had friends around more that we could talk with. There's a couple things here, and then I have a question for him. But it's interesting. About 3 years ago, I was talking with somebody that was talking about organic rugs that if you drop food on it, it would gobble it up.
Huh.
Coming in the future sometime when we can get this whole thing more together, you see, it would gobble up dust. Just small particles that wouldn't nibble your toes or anything.
Is that possible, Charles?
Well, this is what Shore Hall's thing was all about. He has this thing called the foglet theory, and he has this whole paradigm, these little nanomechanical gadgets that are like dust particles themselves. They just drift around, and they're designed to sort of like encounter something and neutralize it. It could be microbes, it could be dust particles, it could be any number of things that these foglets are sort of designed to encounter and then in some way make them less harmful than they currently are. He also, of course, has gone into quite a bit of theoretical concepts about how to have foglets that assemble on cue to a macro object that can sort of, in a benign way, do something to neutralize something else that's undesirable. Nobody has done this yet, but at least the thinking has gone to the direction.
In that direction. The only problem with that, of course, and the thing that worries me is, here it is, ladies and gentlemen, the rug that eats food that gets spilled, little particles of dust and all the rest of it. But then somehow, 10 years later, something horribly goes wrong with the rug, and it kills every living thing on it.
Well, this is the whole point. And I mean, that might be kind of a comical example. But I can see where things like... I've had people come to me with all kinds of ideas. They want to have clothes where the cloth changes color like a chameleon. And
right.
In the nano world, sure, why not? What the heck? You could have shape-changing dinnerware that, you know, instead of a cup, it becomes a saucer or something. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's just completely ridiculous almost. But you cross a certain threshold, and it's like, well, anything goes. But as I said at the very beginning of the program, every time you encounter another one's increments, just remember, there's always a risk value, and the size of the gain usually is matched rather exactly by the size of the risk increment.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osmond. Hi.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Morning. About an hour ago, you had a caller from inside the Beltway who was just gloom and doom. He was frightened to death by these things. And I think that's a reflection of where he's located and possibly his job. You know, a lot of these concepts have been covered in science fiction previously. The Stardance trilogy by Spider and Jeannie Robinson comes clearly to mind. The opposite of a terrorist is a rapturist. The opposite of someone who would use these technologies for destruction is someone who would blithely use them to make everybody rich and make everybody happy. And that's a sign of higher intelligence as far as I'm concerned.
Well, in a sense, I think you're right. And the people that come to my class, I've given a number of lectures, and I've traveled around, I've gone to other conferences and so on. And when I give one of my talks, what interests me is this really broad and diverse range of people that come in from really completely seemingly unrelated aspects of life, from serious scientists to social workers to people that, you know, just do ordinary daily work, but they have a particular philosophy that seems to match and connect well with this vision.
Uh-huh.
And what you're saying kind of makes sense, i.e., if we weren't interfered with by powers that be that don't like their apple cart being upset, yes, this could be the implementation path. But this is kind of where the yin and yang of this whole process comes in. Technically, is it possible to enrich the daily life of the average person via this technology matrix? Absolutely. I'd love to do that. But will we be allowed to? Well, there is a bit of an... And Art used the word war, and that could be a little strong, but yes. I don't think so. It could be a serious one, yes.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osmond. Hi.
Hi, I'm calling from the Weimar on the Willamette up here in Portland.
Yes.
My name is Sandra.
Yes, Sandra.
Cassandra. Yes, judging from what's come out of Berkeley in the past, like, you know, the nuclear testing, the plutonium you stuck up the Black Porter's leg, you know, that he had to live with, you didn't even check up on him for, you know, 25 years, he lived with it and finally died.
We had this isolating from Lawrence Livermore lab on
Hazel O'Leary's hearing. You know, the black lady, his daughter was on there saying, you know, she doesn't want to hear how this guy was a hero for the Cold War. And then her exiting statement there was, he sure was a hero of the Cold War. This is what you people do. Nothing is ever good has ever come out of Berkeley or Stanford. If you look into the background of who those people, who those institutions are named for, your new spiritualism is sickening. The curriculums that have come out of Stanford are totally sickening.
All right.
You think your new little god nuclear religion.
Ma'am. Ma'am, I'm going to turn you down until you pause. I don't want to hang up on you. Will you pause for a moment, please?
Yes.
All right. I think you got a lot out. Let him respond.
Well, I'm very sorry. I mean, in a very, very broad, generalized sense, I can sort of get the sense of the emotional sort of off-the-edge kind of aspect of it.
Off the edge, right?
But you have no idea who I am personally. You have no idea what I've done.
Where
not conditionalized
are you
my work.
Institute or Litton? Litton's the one that popularized that synergism crap to prove that 2 and 2 is 5. I'm reading it right here in the Sovereign State of ITT. I'm reading all these books. You know, I missed out. On the 60s, I was blissed out or something. But I'm going over this whole Earth catalog, this new Millennium Edition, and every horrible, you know, this facilitator and groupthink and everything is this whole religion you're putting out.
You're never going to save the world.
You're not going to do it.
I'm not putting out anything.
Earth fascist.
Ma'am, look, I'm leaving you on. At least let it be a conversation. Please let it be a conversation, ma'am. I don't want to have to hang up on you. pause every now and then.
I can always say that I feel sorry for the caller because I think that she's been so overwhelmed, perhaps, by an incredibly diverse range of stuff that she suddenly absorbed. That, in other words, it's difficult to argue with anyone if, A, there's a lack of cohesive logic, if you will, and, B, people have to be intelligent.
You are the virus. You are the cancer.
Well, now, there she said something.
Well,
Charles, have you thought about that?
Actually, my response might be as follows, and I can't talk if she's going to blast in my ear. So.
No, I'm not going to let her do that, but she said something significant. She said, you are the virus. You are the cancer.
Well,
have you ever thought that maybe you are?
I think that people, because they see a symbol of something, they glom onto this entire world and say, oh, okay, that's the orifice to which all this evil comes. The reality is as follows, and I'm going to do the best I can.
Where do you get your money? You get your money from politicians and these corporate foundations.
Actually,
where do you get your money to do this horrible research?
Actually, the research that is being done that I'm part of.
And you'll probably cause toxic cows.
Well, now, hold on.
He's
trying to answer your question. The money that you do your work with comes from?
Okay. It usually is trying to be oriented towards solving a problem with someone.
No, comes from. Where does the money come from?
In today's world, it comes mostly from consortia.
The Rockefeller Foundation. Carnegie Foundation. The Ford Foundation.
No, I haven't gotten money from the Ford Foundation.
The Sloan Kettering Foundation.
Well,
why don't they put that money toward the national debt and get us out of debt for paying for this kind of research?
Well, all I can say is that
blew up Hiroshima. And then you have the gall to stand down there and have your sex orgies in public saying you're saving the world.
Sex orgies.
I really can't respond to any of this.
Yeah, a sex orgies went too far.
Yeah. But, you know, I can sense the frustration. I know how it is when people are sort of in an isolated world and they just see this huge plethora of stuff and they kind of go like they can't grapple on it. They need some point of reference. And the thing I might want to share, just to respond in the best way possible.
Well, she went off the deep end, but
yeah.
The one comment that I really thought was a relevant question and one that you probably ought to think about yourself was whether you are, in fact, the cancer, the virus.
I'll respond the following way. When I was doing some work at Livermore and people that I knew from that environment, and we were designing components for some of the FBI's work, the thought was, oh, God, we're the death mongers. We're causing all this horrible stuff to occur. And
yeah.
There's actually some idiot that blew up a bomb in the park.
What she was saying.
Stupid nonsense like that.
Yep.
Okay, fine. The response is that, no, we were these surgeons who were trying to create the best precise machine to neutralize the other machine that could be thrust upon it that would, in fact, cause death.
Are you
that
sure?
That was our target goal.
Yeah, are you
at
sure,
least
though?
As far as I worked on, that was the target goal.
Okay, but, Charles, are you sure that that was not the delusional psychology that was delivered to you in order that you might do what you were doing, justify in your own mind what you were doing. Listen, I guess we're not done. You want to hold on?
Oh, sure, I'll hang.
All right. Charles Ostman is my guest, and we're talking about nanotechnology and more.
Taking calls on the Wild Card Line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
All right, we're now going back to Charles Ostman. On the part of that lady, again, Charles, do you acknowledge the possibility that the route you've been talking about, the science route, the one she complained bitterly about and finally lost it altogether, might be the wrong route, and that the right route, the one we're supposed to be on, is not a scientific route. It's not one that leads to molecular manipulation, but one that is spiritual instead.
I think it should be both. And that's, I think, where that woman's failure point was. She was so completely overwhelmed and just absolutely, you know, everything was this horrible thing. That's, nothing's an absolute. Things are always taken in balance. And I think that if you try to go down one path to the extreme exclusion of another, that in of itself is a flaw. That's like a design flaw, if you will, and that's the failure point of the organism.
Here's a kind of an interesting question for you, and then we're back to the phones.
Okay.
Dear Art, could you please ask Charles how soon, if ever, he could envision time travel through the use of nanotechnology?
Well, that's a very obtuse question, but I appreciate what the person's going after. I think I said back in the first hour that one of the real attributes of that nanotechnology is the idea that you can build the materials you can't build now.
Right.
And the whole idea of being able to contrive gravity well events and et cetera. Well, I think in general, although, again, this is not the area of physics I'm most familiar with, the theory being that once you've crossed into this other domain where you can sort of bend gravity and bend time space, and yeah, at that point, time and gravity are sort of interchangeable. I wouldn't rule it out, but I'm not qualified to get it.
That's right. I think mainstream science has determined that at the event horizon of a black hole, for example, time travel would indeed be possible.
I think the interpretation that I'm willing to accept, and I've heard a whole handful of them, is that a black hole is sort of like a perforation into another dimension, or another dimension set, you might say.
Yes.
And there all of a sudden time becomes a singularity, and, you know, a million light years suddenly happens with a blink of an eye. I mean,
so if you could create then an artificial event horizon...
At the edge of theory, yes. And who knows? I mean, wormholes and all these kind of things? Absolutely. I think it's another one of those sort of no-holds-barred, where once you cross a certain threshold, it's like a Pandora's box. All these things happen.
All right. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Good morning.
Hello, Charles. Hello, Art.
Hi.
I'm Doug, the G-Man from Clovis, California.
Yes, sir.
I was kind of a little upset, especially the way that one caller, whatever her name was, lost control, because I really know what she's talking about, and I don't, forget about all that. Well, I have a question.
Sure.
See, because I believe that nanotechnology is a reality.
In certain flavors, it's already being done, yes.
So, considering if that is a reality, do you realize what we have done?
Yeah, I think he does, or what we can
That's
do.
Why she got so upset.
Yeah, I know.
It's your book, Art, The Quickening.
I know.
Let's give ding, ding, ding.
I know.
Your book is the horn, Art, because, if you want to comment, or if you want me to, if you just comment, I'll ask another question.
No, well, I'm glad to comment. No, my book is the horn. I know that. But I don't know what it is that we're blowing to warn about. I'm not sure whether it's this
or
something else. I don't come to those conclusions. I'm just a talk show host. So, yeah, that's what my book is. But I don't have the answers. I'm smart enough to know I don't have the answers. Anyway, you've got another question?
Well, I would just comment on that to say that it's a call to reality, no matter what you believe.
My purpose for trying to communicate this stuff at all, because I'll tell you this flat out, most of the people I work with and or have become familiar with, they don't talk at all. They just, I mean, they see me as being kind of out there because I'm willing to try. I feel compelled to want to try because I feel it's an obligation to do so. I feel like I'm coming from other worlds, almost like Marco Polo or something.
Sure.
Some other domain, and I bring little trinkets back and say, well, look at this little thing that I can fetch up as a kind of a symbolic reference to this other realm out there that you might want to know about. I don't necessarily have to do this, but I feel if I've been allowed the privilege to have been experienced all these different parallel development streams, and there's a handful of folks that sort of have this kind of broad-based, multi-threaded technical background, but at the same time feel the desire and perhaps have the sense of articulating, to bring it out into the outside
right.
world, if I've been allowed that gift, or whatever you want to call it, then I feel like it's my obligation to try to use it in some context.
Well, I'm glad you're here, if that's what it comes down to. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hi.
Hello. This is Joe from Thunder Bay, Canada.
Hi, Joe.
Hi. Yeah, well, I would like to make two comments, if I may, first.
Sure.
Okay, well, it goes with the other callers. Well, the one part is, what I believe, is that if Charles wasn't doing this, then the people with Charles, there would be the other people, and everybody's looking at the bad things. Well, they could use those bad things against us. If you look at it that way, do you follow me?
Yeah, no, I follow exactly what we're saying. And I think that the folks that I hang around with, or try to hang around with if possible, are the benign side, if you want to call it that. I can say to the... On behalf of the woman who was ranting and raving, yeah, there is a really dark side out there. I completely understand this. And what made it so sad was that she was so blinded by that sense that she was completely incapable of trying to sort out that there are individual human beings that, God help us all, at least there's a handful of them in there, who do see that we have to correctly manage this arena that we're about to be thrust into.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, all bets are off. And so for all, you know, I try to encourage as many people as possible who might take an interest in some of this to become informed, underline the word informed, participants.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and my other comment was, well, just sort of in defense or whatever, what I believe, that pretty much everything, and I don't mean this to offend anybody, but even religion, you know, can be scary.
Oh, yeah.
It's used the wrong way.
It's used the wrong way, absolutely. I agree with that completely.
Everything. But my question is, with the technology, what do you think, what do you see for, say, with disabilities and whatnot for people?
Oh, I think it's tremendously possible. I mean, I'll give you a good example of this.
Spinal injuries.
You were asking some time ago about bonding neural tissue to artificial devices. This has been done for years now. Gregory Kozak over here at Stanford at the Integrated Systems Development Group has been doing this for several years. There's a person named Peter Fromhertz at the Maxwell Planck Institute in Germany who's doing this. There's a company, actually, called BCI Inspire, both as a service can now provide. If you walk in the door and say, here's a silicon device or some other device that has micro-scale features and I want to entice neural fibers to actually bond to these items and have them useful in some kind of sensory prosthesis or neural repair kind of capacity, you know, you just tell them the spec and they essentially manufacture the device for you on demand. In fact, IEEE Spectrum published a piece about 3.5-4 months ago on retinal implants. In fact, that's an area I've been looking to myself for some time. University of Utah started a piece several years ago. In fact, the NIH has been financing or supporting neural prosthesis systems going back 14 years. The problems that are most often encountered. In fact, I just gave a talk in Texas along with a couple of other fellows, including the developer of the cochlear implant. And we had a very long chat after the talk was over. Dr. Robert Shannon is the name. And the idea is not so much can we get the right biocompatibility interface between device X and tissue X. Usually, particularly with nerve bundles, can we find the right nerve?
All right,
physically get them to hook up in the right way.
Right, but when we get really down to manipulation at the molecular level...
Oh, then that's a whole different story.
Then, for example,
sure.
If somebody were to lose an arm,
mm-hmm.
could we grow an arm?
Theoretically, that would be the thought, yes.
Yeah. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hi.
Yeah, this is Andrew calling from Fresno, California. I would just like to comment to Charles that I believe that it's possible that such a device may already exist in outer space. And
What kind of a device?
The the intelligent molecular interdimensional machine.
I couldn't really say.
Well, I feel that... in the first chapter of Ezekiel, that he described something very similar to this.
Wheels within wheels, eh?
Wheels within wheels. Right. I read it in the Hebrew Chaldee Dictionary, and it came across...
Well, but it's a matter, sir, thank you, of interpretation, which is exactly what it is, interpretation. Wheels within wheels, maybe. Maybe it refers to that. Maybe it refers to something completely different. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Don in Austin, Texas.
Hi, Don.
And I've noticed the last few months that ever since I first heard the term the quickening, I guess my first thought was that it was something out of Highlander the movie or something, but
no.
Since the months have passed on, I do definitely see what you're talking about. First with the discovery, well, I won't call it a discovery, but the whole deal with cloning and everything and the whole ethical issue behind cloning.
Oh my, yes.
I wonder how quickly someone would say, no, it's wrong, it's bad, speaking of nanotechnology, if they were faced with some kind of deathly illness, you know, something that could kill them, and maybe they've lost an arm or something
to
that effect.
What you're trying to say is it's very easy to armchair and say, okay, because of these high moral standards, you have to obey law, but for me personally, well, I want that arm, you know, obviously.
Well, let me give you a very good example. There was a public service announcement that was running not very long ago, folks, that said, and I'm going to have to paraphrase it, but it was a guy who needed a heart transplant. And he was discussing, so I bet you heard this, he was discussing with his doctor about the heart transplant, and he said, oh, just, Doc, one thing, I don't want a heart from a Jew, I don't want a heart from a black guy, I don't want a heart from an American native, you know, it's got to be a white guy's heart. And the doc said, well, then you're going to die. And he immediately did a little rethinking on the subject. Right.
Right.
So there you are. Anyway, Charles, onward.
Sure.
Wild card line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is Ken, the trucker from Las Vegas.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Mr. Osman, have you ever met the Andromeda strain or Spear?
Well,
I've
read Andromeda strain. I think I know where you're going with this. You're saying, gosh, if we hatch a quasi-viral component for intracellular corrective chemistry, could the thing mutate and suddenly end life as you know it? Sure. Those are the risk versus, and I'm not saying we should do that. I'm just saying in the ruminations of theoretical considerations as to how things could be done, viruses do provide an interesting framework with which to build some kind of molecular scale machine that could perform tests, but has anyone done this yet?
Okay, but
no.
Let me
and
ask you.
Would we even want to try?
Okay,
Probably not.
Okay, but suppose you were doing that kind of work. Wouldn't you literally have to be inside a level 4 type environment?
Oh, absolutely. You're not kidding. This is at the extreme outer frontier of biohazard standards. Absolutely. No question about it. And I myself would not want to encourage this. I'm only saying that we have to understand, you're looking at such an enormous range of options. You go, okay, well, here's problem X. Could this be a solution worth considering? What's the potential risk exposure? Okay, does the risk exposure outweigh the gain exposure and or, you know, in what context could the risk exposure be managed? Chances are they'll probably never do this.
Well, I don't know about that. Suppose, for example, you're working on a manipulation that would turn a switch that would stop cancer cells from growing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the upside.
That's the upside.
The possible downside could be something that would race around the globe in a day or two and literally knock everybody off. Do you go to work? Do you go into a level 4 environment and begin work on that kind of thing?
I'll
or do you say, I don't want anything to do with that?
I'll tell you what scares me about that kind of a scenario, and that's not that far off from the kind of scenario I personally my trepidations about. Here in this country, or let's say in most sort of stabilized Western countries where you have some modicum of everyone within the community sort of knows each other, there's a sense of community sort of, more or less, in that domain. Probably not. It would definitely be something where somebody might be playing inside of a secure facility, but they would just play and get that far. But in some other country, perhaps, where the standards weren't quite that tightly maintained, where the interstitial bureaucracy that deals with this kind of stuff.
Iraq, for example.
Yeah, or whatever. God help us.
Yeah.
In that environment, I could see a biohazard suddenly popping up where they don't particularly care if the results are benign or not. You know, maybe they just kind of want to make a go of it and see how it turns out. That, to me, is really, you know, we have enough scare. You want to get scared about something. Right now, we have from the former Soviet bloc, especially from the Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and areas of that nature, this unbelievable flood of nuclear components and former nuclear scientists. And, I mean, the Pandora's, talk about Pandora's box, we've gone way beyond that edge. And this is really frightening. And I think that you have any number of tin horn dictators and or their cohorts that even now, you know, they've got some stuff stashed away. And if they ran to make a bomb, they probably could under duress.
Biologicals. Bad guys with oil money.
Bad guys with oil money. And so you translate biologicals in that picture. That's where something really bad could happen. That's my personal take on that.
What about treaties? Useless, huh? They're talking about a chemical ban now. It's ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous. It's not only ridiculous, but it kind of, how am I going to phrase this carefully? It shows how inept we are at even understanding what's at stake.
You're exactly right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Osmond. Hi.
Yeah, this is Freeman out in the middle of the South Dakota prairie.
Yes, sir.
I am so fascinated with this. I had premonitions about this about 25 years ago, what a person could do with a computer. And I am enjoying this. I only get to listen to you when I'm on the road because I'm self-employed and I make garbage dumpsters out here in the middle of nowhere. And I am so fascinated that some of these premonitions that I've had such a long time ago are coming true. My heart's with something. I got goosebumps. I'm really enjoying this, and I just enjoy your show all to pieces.
Well, thank you. I'll accept that. Thank you, and I guess no question. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Charles Osmond. Hi.
Well, hi. Good morning, Art.
Morning.
Bob in Las Vegas.
Hello, Bob.
Charles, I've been interested in nanotechnology for 4 or 5 years now, and the one question that I don't think you've answered yet tonight, and I'm really curious about, is how do you go about manipulating the molecules and the atoms at that level that you can't see them? What kind of process
is
that?
That's a very good question, and I have
together?
An answer for you.
All right,
This is Nanotech 101, and it's very understandable and it's very answerable.
All right, hold on. Both of you, hold on. We will. I'm going to hold you both over until after the break. Is that satisfactory?
Yeah, that's fine, sure.
All right, it's going to take a pretty good answer, I suspect. How do you do that? How do you manipulate something you can't see? But something so important, something so small, so important, that when you do manipulate it, you have a machine of creation. I can about hear that lady's answer to that right now, can't you? From the high desert, I'm Art Bell, and this is the Independent American CBC Radio Network.
At 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
That's what it is. I'm Art Bell, and my guest, the entire 5 hours, obviously, has been Charles Osmond. The subject, it's kind of buried. From the Internet, growing into what it's going to be shortly, to nanotechnology, which would seem to have no limit in terms of discussion about what we can do. But the question is, what should we do? And there it will go. Caller, are you still there?
Here.
All right. I want to be sure your question is laid out again, and you really did ask, how in the world can you manipulate something you can't even see? Is that about right?
Yeah, well, like, you know, atoms and molecules. I can visualize it happening, but I, with the technology that I'm aware of, you know, how do you go about it? Is it a chemical process, electrical? Or, you
actually,
know?
You not only mentioned both, but this is kind of a riddle. I don't mean to be coy, but in fact, the answer is more simple than you might imagine. The same device that looks at the molecules also can move them. And this is where it gets really interesting.
What is the device that looks at them?
Okay, there's two different flavors, if you will. There's the STM and the AFM. The AFM is an atomic force microscope, and the STM is a scanning tunneling electron microscope. In both cases, well, okay, I have to differentiate now. In the case of the STM, imagine, if you will, a conical-shaped tip, almost like a needle that you'd use for playing on a phonograph record, old vinyl record.
Yes.
Only on a much smaller scale. Now, as it turns out, electron flow, or electrostatic charge, that's a better choice of words, through open space has an extremely linear relationship between the distance between the two conductive surfaces and the charge states. Therefore, if you have a feedback loop that controls a device that can move this tip up and down in extremely precise increments,
yes,
by keeping the charge constant, you really can draw a topographical feature map of whatever it is that the thing is scanning across,
uh-huh,
up down to the molecular and atomic level. Now, by changing the charge status ever so carefully, you suddenly can pick up the molecule in question and sort of wrest it out of its little nest that it's embedded in. That's how this is done.
Does that help, caller?
Yeah, I'm wondering another step then. Is it science fiction or fact that once you have built some machines, some nanomachines, that you can then program those machines to build others?
That's precisely the direction it's going in. There's a company called Nanoscript that actually manufactures this as a piece of personable equipment. You can go out and buy one tomorrow if you like.
You can.
Yes. Now, where things get a little bit fuzzy is one tip at a time. That's a real slow way to do things. But if you have an array of tips, thousands, perhaps millions, all actuating simultaneously, the problem there has been up until recently, I underline the word until recently, maintaining atomic precision on a tip-to-tip basis. In other words, each tip has to have almost identical features, topologies, size, volumetric displacement, etc. But recent discoveries at Caltech and elsewhere have made the commonality of feature sets between tips much more manageable. Even now, as we talk, they're talking about arrays where they have hundreds of tips, and I happen to have a personal friend who's right in the very middle of all these work. Now, that's the STM.
Would it be too simplistic to suggest that nothing can better manipulate a molecule than another molecule?
Well, you just answered the riddle of the atomic force microscope, because the AFM, instead of measuring charge status as a control feedback process, it instead uses a little, this is hard to explain, but it uses a very, very small, and I do mean small, bendable cantilever, at the end of which you can attach the molecule of choice. That molecule will then have an attractor-like effect upon the other molecules they're interacting with. And particularly for biological procedures, this is a wonderful way to go. You can use peptides and enzymes and all kinds of things. Now, there's a third sort of in-between stage. There's a company called Cellular Robotics, Los Alamos. I just happen to know the folks that started the company. And they're using laser light to perform molecular scale, sort of like what you might call severing and reattachment. It used to be that if you're going to do gene splicing, you select an enzyme to sort of break apart the gene pair of choice and reconnect it again. But it's kind of sloppy and kind of messy. It's a solution-based process. With the laser light, you really, on almost a mechanical basis, shine light at the right molecular junction site, and you really do either take it apart or put it back together. So all three of these processes can work together depending upon the assembly process. And the point, I think, that the caller really exposed, and this is appropriate, that we're right at the very threshold of being able to build machines that build the other components of the machine. And yes, when we cross that threshold, yes, that's where the real velocity, the quickening occurs.
All right. Wild card line, you're on the air with Charles Osman. Good morning.
Hello, it's good to be on the air with you guys today.
Where are you, sir?
I'm in Salt Lake.
Salt Lake, all right.
I just have a quick question, or a comment, actually, form of either one. What is it that, now with this new, it's almost a new take on reality, or a new absolute, and one of the questions I wanted to ask you, you've said quite a few times that there are no absolutes.
That's right.
But if you to say there are no absolutes, well, that's one absolute, that there's no absolutes. And then you're using...
Okay, well, it's a little... I've been on the phone for almost 5 hours. All granted,
I understand.
If you had been sharper, I would have probably caught on to that.
Yeah, but also, you know, it's like I can't figure out how... And it's not a personal thing at all, but
okay.
I don't understand how you can use reality to disprove reality. You know, just... I guess, in a sense, I'm just trying to understand, is this technology... The people who are in charge or in control of this technology, are they going to be respectful of the individual's rights on the Earth, or is it going to be dropped away for the better of this science? Which
nothing,
is more
nothing,
important?
Nothing like a quick, simple question, I think. No.
Yeah.
because and
we're
again,
both tired. We're all tired.
Yeah.
And again, this is sort of like the obvious question of questions, because, again, we're not talking about a single thing or a single... You know, like one company made this gadget and suddenly changed the world. It's not like that at all. It's the extreme opposite. It's an incredibly diverse plethora of different technologies which converge, hence that's why I read the book Age of Convergence, because that's the process I'm trying to describe. And the rate of convergence is an acceleration vector, just like as Hart harps upon the time factor, I harp upon the convergence factor, and the two do synergistically interact, by the way. But the point is that it's this synergy grid that allows a bunch of different laboratories using 12 different types of technologies to sort of like invent a technology matrix that could not have existed even, say, 5 years ago. There is no single authority or body. Now, what may come out of this, potentially, is certain classes of technologies which have unusually far-reaching implications may end up being, you know, sort of taken over by some, or, you know, entity that says we want to now control such. But the way that this is evolving, as I see it to be, the Internet is kind of like a model, it's like a training session, if you will. We're being trained because of the fact that we're being drawn to this Internet symbiosis with the human species. And it is such a decentralized, interconnected series of functionalities that the nano domain is kind of like that as well. In other words, you're not going to see, as in the case of oil, these giant, you know, huge multi-billion-dollar facilities that have to drain oil out of the ground and refine it. No, it's the exact opposite. I could have a nano foundry sitting here in my living room the size of a shoebox or less.
Right.
And there could be endless numbers of them in all different types.
Wow.
Well, that's the essence of how I see this being played out.
I understand, and that makes sense. And I'll tell you, I and a lot of people that I know stand, I can speak for a lot of people listening right now, we stand very firmly with Art Bell as individuals, but also in step with Art Bell, and if you can prove to us the same thing, that you will, you know, respect the rights or respect, you know, humanity and not be above it or below it, we'll stand by you too, because it's an incredible science, and Art, you're going in the greatest directions.
Well,
I'm so glad that the way things are going, and I'm not going to ask you how you're doing either.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hi.
Hello. This is Tracy from Kansas City.
Tracy, you're a little hard to hear.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's a little hard to hear this.
This any better?
That's better, yeah. Sure.
Okay. I just have some questions about what kind of safeguards would there be to avoid people from using the darker purposes.
All right. That's like asking, well, maybe it isn't.
It's still a very broad question. You have, I mean, certain categories of stuff I could say, well, in the biological range, sure, I mean, there should be some way of registering. For instance, just the one slim little area of synthetic organisms, should there be a regulatory, like the FDA or something, that says if you're going to invent an organism, it has to be registered and with some sort of codified classification process? Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, I think that we clearly in the realm of the biological, there's a lot of, I think, pretty standard sorts of regulatory practices that can be deployed. Where it gets a little fuzzier, of course, is in when you start inventing things that are really, really different than the kinds of things we're normally used to now. And this is kind of the area that I was trying to allude to some time ago. It's not just that we can replicate something or kind of make a somewhat different version of something that we currently have. Mm-hmm. It's when you start inventing things that just don't exist at all. You know, new classes of materials, you know, very, very complex machines that are partly organic and partly inorganic, and they have self-propagating properties and, you know, whatever. I mean, it's just a wide plethora of things. How you invent a bureaucracy system that tracks along with the evolution. I mean, right now, even with the most mundane technologies, it's taken years for, say, the patent office to sort of catch up with the current-day world of things. We've had tremendous problems with the State Department being bright enough to sort of understand what a supercomputer is versus what a desktop computer is. I remember earlier times when this seemed laughable. But, you know, these are mundanely simple things compared to the kind of stuff that will be inventable in the near future should there be some kind of nano authority registration system that you could define. If it had X amount of nano-related processes in its manufacturing cycle, it therefore qualifies as a nano thing that therefore has to be subject to this bureaucracy.
Yeah, the problem is, ultimately, Newt Gingrich is not the most powerful man in the world, nor is Bill Clinton or anybody else. The most powerful man in the world will ultimately be the man with the most powerful program.
With the most powerful software and or the people that know how to apply the software in the most functional way.
Exactly. Yeah, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hi.
Hello, this is Chris. I'm calling from Tacoma.
Hi, Chris.
Well, this is all kind of overwhelming information.
Yes.
And being somewhat computer illiterate, it even is more so. But, you know, I was just wondering, being able to replicate a lot of things, like
yes.
He was talking about meat.
Yes.
For instance. Wouldn't that make a lot of things obsolete?
Yes.
I mean, we had discussed that earlier. That's true.
Yes, it would make, eventually, at its ultimate, the entire industrialized society.
Well, that would create a whole other problem, I would say.
Well, I
had
alluded,
wouldn't it?
I had alluded to earlier that as we transition to what I refer to as the virtual asset-based commodity, you know, economic system, which will be spawned from the virtual terraform, and I don't know if you, how many hours ago, I've been on the air now for 5 hours.
Yep.
Yeah, I think in hour number two I was kind of coming about the stuff.
Okay, well, I missed that.
Okay, well, I'm kind of fading away, so I can't go through the detail of it all, but the point is that, yes, there will be, in my opinion, a layer of chaos. We're going to be transitioning away from these orthogonal, hard asset-based, geographically defined, autonomous nation-state-based economy systems and going into a completely different realm. But that transitional layer, and it may be...
It's going to be chaotic.
It'll be chaos. It will be a lot of fallout. It will be a lot of restructuring. But I already accept that to be the case. And I know that this coincides with, just interestingly enough, with the same timeline that all these other prophecy folks are talking about with the Earth and all planets. Who knows what these things are going to come
just a
time.
Big coincidence,
but,
right?
But at least in my world, I mean, from the stuff that I'm aware of that I can theorize and draw charts and graphs, this I can prove because of these theorems, this is the world I'm familiar with. And it is interesting that it do coincide. I must admit, I hear these things and I go, well, is there a macro pattern to all this?
Well, you know, as it is, I think people are bombarded with so much information these days that it's hard for people to process it all.
Yes.
And that's what I was talking about.
It's very overwhelming.
Well, this is what I was talking about in hour number three, about the concept of synthetic sentience becoming a common resource, a strategically necessary resource, because the volume and complexity of knowledge processing will go beyond human capacity. That's precisely why we'll be drawn into a human
Well, in a lot of technical fields, Charles, that has already occurred.
And it has already occurred.
There are people who repair things not by understanding how they actually function, but by just pulling out modules and putting in the new module.
And that's kind of a real minimal way of looking, but you're right. That is kind of the first one of that problem.
Yeah. First time caller line, you're on the air with Charles Ostman. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Art.
Yes.
Art, this is Jamie. I'm calling from Lake Tahoe.
Yes, sir.
My hat's off to you. I've listened to your show for years and made a difference in my life. My compliments to the guest tonight, Charles. You've attracted quite a few interesting callers, some very interesting people.
Yes, it has been a very diverse collection of folks, I must say.
It is very. I'm sort of like a guest technology-based guy. I was started reading Scientific American when I was 10 years old, you know, back in 66.
Sure.
And it blows my mind to this day that, I mean, a Scientific American used to be relevant for a good 2 or 3 years, so
right.
anybody who bought them saved them forever.
Right.
And now
I
look at the Scientific Americans that I get in the mail, and after a few months, they're sort of like, why bother? It's obsolete information.
I call it knowledge velocity.
Exactly.
And this is part of the quickening.
Well, how about a question to pose to you. It sounds a couple times you've made a sort of tangential reference to being somewhat ostracized in your own scientific community for taking a stand other than the majority.
No, not so much the way I heard it. Not for taking a stand, but by talking about it.
Exactly. Thank you. That's precisely.
Okay, so then, no, you haven't taken a stand then.
Well, I do have certain what I would call ethical or moral criteria that I think should be rules that everyone would want to abide by, but... to the extent that a lot of folks, I mean, for instance, a lot of the folks that I work with or, you know, run into at various symposiums, like, don't know that I write for magazines like Mondo and so forth. And if they did, they'd be horrified. So I really have to kind of play this rather careful, delicate game where I don't want to lie to anybody. I'd never want to misrepresent anything, but I might be careful about how I reveal what I'm doing just because it's the only way I can get access to the world that they are embedded in.
I understand. I am in this somewhat in the same realm where I deal in construction and law and technology and very comfortable in the field. I understand the protocol that you're talking about.
Right.
But as I get older, I'm now 41, I realize that the technology I don't have to worry about because I can... if you sneeze today, the technology passes you by, but it doesn't take more than, you know, a few weeks to catch up on every week lost. It's pretty simple that way if anybody's willing to study enough.
Right.
So I don't worry about that, but I know one thing, that the moral, ethical, spiritual questions sit there silently, and they will wait there until I'm done with my folly to address the real issue.
And this is perhaps part of the test that we're about to be tried by, i.e., and if you want to go into the religion, you know, one thing I will say about the prophecy and all this thing, I'm not a religious person by nature per se. I mean, I have my own personal internal spiritual belief system.
No, it's generally come true.
I have read the Upanishad just briefly. I've read the Bible. I've looked at the Talmud and the Quran just to kind of get an overview to see, you know, what were these things all about. I noticed that there are certain common features, no matter how divergent or culturally different by what lens their particular interpretation of the general rule system works, the rule system themselves has certain common features, certain moral codes and ethics that were common to all cultures. And, interestingly enough, almost without exception, even the Mayan books and so forth, they talk about this test point we're about to come to, which happens to be right about now, as a matter of fact, where this enormous global scale change is about to occur. And I look at all this and I go, just as an empirical data set, it's interesting. There should be something to this. You know, what did they see? How did they see this? And under what context was this conclusion drawn?
Well, I know that clearly you don't feel that you're the virus, that you're the cancer.
Well, I try to be as benevolent in this process as possible. I could pretend it does not exist and simply exclude myself from this entire loop. I think it's my obligation, however, rather to be a participant in it, but try to be a positive participant.
All right. Charles, believe it or not, we've chewed up 5 hours.
Unbelievable, but it's been fun. And it's been good.
It's been good, yes. It's been very good. Good for me, certainly. So I think I'm going to close this down for the night and say, Charles, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for being here, and we will have you back again.
Sounds great.
Take care.
You too.
That's Charles Ostman, folks, on nanotechnology, the Internet, and much more. And we will have him back again. And I suspect we had better not wait a year and a half to do so, or we're not going to understand a word he says. Anyway, that's it for tonight. Sorry, we're out of time. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night.